Your name's not Dan, you're not coming in. Your name's not Dan, you're not coming in. Your name's not Dan, you're not coming in.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show, Friday the 19th of March, 2021. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part, Russia withdraws her ambassador from Washington, Anatoly Antonov, after Biden is prompted to say Putin is a killer by the ABC TV interviewer George Stephanopoulos. Yet very little news coverage for something that's never happened before. US and Soviet ambassadors remaining in place even during the supposedly the closest superpowers came to nuclear war during the 40-year-long Cold War. That's the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. So is it worse now than it was then? The main thing for us to determine the ways in which the difficult Russian-American relations that Washington has led into a dead end in recent years could be rectified. That's what Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said in a statement on their website. She says, "We are interested in preventing their irreversible degradation of the Americans recognize the risks involved." And also in the second part tonight, more from Steve Hilton. Every Sunday evening on Fox News, The Next Revolution, his latest from last Sunday on the lockdown contradictions and carnage. And we take a look at the Boston airport arrest of the top Harvard professor who was taking samples of some mystery biological matter backwards and forwards from Boston to Wuhan. Maybe COVID-19 wasn't made in Wuhan at all. Also, John Harris joins us this week. He has more on the bizarre mystery of the flight of Hitler's deputy Führer, Rudolf Hess, in May 1941 to Scotland. Was a member of the royal family who died in a plane crash a year later, Prince George, waiting at an RAF base to receive Hess with all full honours and to institute a coup d'etat ousting Winston Churchill? Well, that's what John thinks may have been going on. Will he be hearing from him later? And the deaths of two 9/11 truthers and pandemic sceptics, former chair of the UK 9/11 Truth Group, Ian R. Crane, and also Cutting Through the Matrix producer and presenter Alan Watt. Some longer clips from two great voices the treacherous mainstream media has done its best to snuff out while they were still alive. And also a bit on Meghan Markle, victim of the royal racism, or Hollywood psyop, echoes perhaps of the pre-war scandal with Edward and Mrs. Simpson we mentioned last week, but the incredible appearance of the Duchess of Cambridge at the demonstration last Saturday evening in support of Sarah Everard and against her alleged police killer. But first, Martin Summers joins me. We're looking, I think, Martin, pretty much straight away at what's going on with the Labour Party here in Bristol. I mean, some people even talking about it as a kind of far-right NSDAP control freaks. There are several of them in the South West Regional Party who are basically purging Labour in the area, requisitioning branches so that these people can get the right-wing candidates and branch offices installed against the will of the membership. The Southwest Regional Office's regional director, Phil Gaskin, is one of the main instigators of that. And he's got these two gophers called Dominic Collins and Hayley Jackson. Now, this is kind of thrown into pretty strong relief by former Avonmouth Labour councillor Joe Sargent this week. His horrifying resignation letter exposing more of a culture of thuggery and bullying under Bristol's unelected gruesome twosome, Kevin Slocum and the mayor, Marvin Rees. So what do you make of what's been going on, Martin? The latest we've been hearing is to do with various branch committees resigning en masse, and we'll be looking in a minute at the details of the resignation of Joe Sargent, who was always considered by people in Avonmouth to be a loyalist to the mayor, Marvin Rees, basically to the clique that are running the city.
Well, I mean, what's going on in this region is being mirrored across the country. So we've basically got a gloves-off internal fight within the Labour Party. And, of course, Phil Gaskin's been around for quite a long time as a full-time worker for the party. I've come across him in several elections. We are, you know, the old infrastructure, if you like, which basically ran the party during the Blair era, has reasserted its control. And of course, you know, we may argue that political parties are supposedly democratic, but that's not necessarily the case. As we know, political parties are not always democratic internally. You know, Nigel Farage's Brexit party was basically just run by Nigel Farage.
So is the Labour Party becoming like that? It's just basically...
Well, no, it's reverting to what it was like before. Being a member of the Labour Party is like being a member of the Polish United Workers' Party or any of the other East European communist parties. It's basically an infrastructure which has a semi-democratic structure, but of course it's open to manipulation by those with more money, resources.
Let's cut to the chase here, because we're going to be hearing from Marvin Rees in a minute about how much money he seems to have to slosh around. But the long and short of it is a party can rely more or less on two of the main funding streams. With Labour, of course, that includes unions. But, you know, there's city donors who fund parties, and there's also a grassroots membership who not only will fund the party with a small amount every month, a sub, but they're also there when it comes to election time to get out on the streets, knock on doors and do work for free.
Yes. And of course, working those different, funding sources is tremendously important. If you look, I mean, in Britain, it's become more like this than the United States. It really is. You literally have to have millions in the bank if you want to stand in elections. Elections really are, they're not entirely one with money, but money is incredibly important, and which is why in Scandinavian countries, political parties are funded through state funds on the basis of the vote they got at the last relevant election. What we've had in this country is the Tories are funded by big business and big, you know, multimillionaires. The Labour Party under Corbyn was funded by trade unions and by individual members. And of course, one of the things that Starmer has done is move the Labour Party into a position where he and people like him can attract funding from mainstream business interests and wealthy individuals, so that therefore Starmer then becomes less dependent on the trade unions and upon individual members.
Well, I mean, there's a certain amount of sense to what he's doing, isn't he? I mean, we've got a whole load of workers furloughed, the trade unions on their knees, and the potential is here that the individual subs from individual members are starting to dry up, that these are poor people that can't afford to fund a political party anymore.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, in actual fact, the membership of the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn was the highest political party membership in Europe. And in actual fact, it gave the party quite a substantial amount of money to spend. But what subsequently happened is lots of people have resigned and other people have been expelled and others have been suspended. And of course, the strategy from Starmer, as it was under Blair, is to move the funding of the party away from trade unions and individual members, as I've just said, and therefore make it more attractive to business interests and wealthy individuals.
You'll basically bribe before the election for what they want after the election, just like they do with the Tories.
Well, I mean, it's the same with all political
parties. I don't think it is. No, I think various. I mean, there's degrees. There's a whole spectrum of whether parties have any principle. And certainly traditionally, the Labour Party had quite a lot more principle than the other parties when it came to what their social intentions were. But a Bristol councillor has launched this scathing attack, Martin, just after we closed our show last week, actually on Friday evening. Attack, it's called. It's a criticism. I wouldn't necessarily use the word attack myself. On the Labour group after quitting the party. Councillor Joe Sargent's claims alleged there is a culture of fear and bullying, make particular reference to elected Mayor Marvin Rees and to Labour group leader Marge Hickman, dismissed though by the Mayor's office as a personal vendetta by the Mayor's office. Now, we're getting quite a lot of these apparent personal vendettas, including you alleging that I had a personal vendetta, Martin, against Marvin Rees, but there's quite a lot of people on the left of the party that are getting this accusation from the Mayor's office. Her attack comes 2 months before the local elections and just before a full council vote on whether to hold a referendum on the whole principle of having an elected mayor, which the Lib Dems and the Labour, there was a Labour Party councillor that seconded it, that they lost that on Tuesday this week. And we're going to be hearing a bit from that debate a bit later on. She represents, Joe does anyway, Avonmouth and Lawrence Western as an independent now. She quit the Labour group after voting in February against its intention to freeze council rents, a controversial issue which split the group. Now, anyone that knows anything about housing knows that these council rents, a lot of them are paid through housing benefit. And this is one of the reasons the council doesn't want to pay that housing benefit. But she's arguing, she's saying, well, look, you know, you need this money in order to look after the property. And if you don't get an increase in the council rent, then the property can't be properly looked after anymore. But anyway, it's a matter of principle that she wanted to vote. And she found that she was bullied as a result of making that particular vote. Her resignation statement, Martin, describes the Labour Party, released Friday night, March the 12th, Labour Party in Bristol as being focused on power for power's sake, beset with a culture of fear and bullying.
Well, I wasn't from, I haven't been au fait with this. This is the first I've heard of it. I hear what she's saying. I don't know what, you know, whether what she's saying is widely, you know, accepted in the rest of the Labour group or not. But I mean, I hear what's being said here.
She said the Bristol Labour group's dominated by Marvin Rees and Councillor Hickman, although she didn't mention the Alistair Campbell in the situation, who's Kevin Slocum, who a lot of people say is basically running Marvin Rees, telling him where he shouldn't, well, I imagine his advice, whether or not to go in and endorse Alexei Navalny, is Marvin's advice is probably coming from Kevin Slocum. Joe thinks that through their allies, they control the agenda and restrict opportunities for debate on any issues that they don't want to be discussed. She's making public accusations, which a small handful of Labour councillors have expressed privately. Councillor Sargent said Mr. Rees sees local councillors as an annoying inconvenience, has no respect for any members other than those Labour individuals in his inner circle. Now, what she's saying here is that this is a clique running the city. Now, that clique is far too closely connected, Martin. I wonder if you'd agree with this. It seems to the business community. We're talking about former master of the Merchant Venturers, John Savage, who left the Labour Party when Jeremy Corbyn became leader. But he's still very influential in the city, sitting on various boards and things like that. And also, it's interesting that the spin-off from all of this is meaning that almost all the Labour candidates in the forthcoming mayoral, the Metro Mayor elections and the local council elections are all from the party's right, not from the left at all.
Well, I'm not quite sure whether that's true. I mean, the problem with having an elected mayor is that the system allows them to aggrandise power into their own hands, even to the extent of overruling the party. Now, if they then become aligned with the full-time workers of the Labour Party, Marge Hickman, I do know reasonably well because she's my local councillor, and you know she's obviously basically aligned with Marvin, although she's not standing in May; she's retiring. And these kind of internal fights are, in a sense, to do with the mayoral system as a system, because it just does give, you know, basically ultimate power to one individual, and also to do with the fact that the Labour Party has always been, you know, a quarrelsome twin party with a left wing and a right wing, and either one side's winning and the other are losing, and the other side's winning and the other side's losing. And it was ever thus. If you go back in history, you will see that the Labour Party has always had this internal quarrelling as part of the history of the party, because of the nature of the wider electoral system in which they
Would you like to have seen Jeremy Corbyn do something similar to the Labour right to enable the left to be in a position to maybe back in 2019 to fight that as a left-wing party, which maybe some would argue that the Labour Party would have won if they could have got rid of this right-wing influence?
Well, there was a lot of debate about that at the time, because, of course, the bottom line for this will be mandatory reselection, or the possibility of deselecting sitting MPs and councillors. Now, the way in which Corbyn chose to approach the problem was to say, we're not going to basically deselect the existing cadre of parliamentary Labour Party MPs. And of course, that was a big struggle in the 1980s when we had Tony Benn leading the standard bearer of the left. And what Corbyn hoped was that by taking a conciliatory line with the right wing, that they would recognise in the fullness of time that it was in their interests to basically be team players. Now, he could have gone down the road of saying, no, we're going to kick these people out if they're going to oppose us. But if you do that, you've got the Tory press and other news organisations waiting there to pounce on you and say, well, look, this just shows you're all over the place, etc. So it's very difficult for the left to play that game, because even if you do play it, the right wing won't go quietly and there'll be a huge big fight.
Yeah, so but I mean, the consequence of all this
was more conciliatory than that.
Yeah, the consequence of all this is that you've got a Keir Starmer Labour Party in the House of Commons that actually is going along with some of the most draconian of the Tory legislation. For example, this bill, which will allow all sorts of state actors, people who are part of quangos, to kill people with impunity. These sorts of laws, Starmer isn't even bothering to oppose it. In fact, this police crime sentencing and courts bill, which is chugging through at the moment, which is designed to stop protests, to criminalise gypsies and travellers, this sort of thing. They were only convinced to oppose that last week after the Sarah Everard demonstration in London, where the police stormed into a whole load of women holding a protest. Well, it wasn't really a protest. It was a vigil in support of Sarah Everard last weekend. So we've got a Labour Party that it's only at the very, very last minute, if at all, is ever going to really oppose the Tories.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because they abstained on the spy cops bill and on giving the armed forces and the secret services carte blanche, which I think is reprehensible. Of course, all the other opposition parties, including the Lib Dems, Plaid Cymru, the SNP, Greens, had no problem voting against that bill. Now, of course, in any case, even if the whole of the opposition voted against those bills, it would go through because we've got a majority of 80 for the Tories on 43% of the vote. Now, what's actually happened at the Sarah Everard vigil was that because people went out on the streets, as it were, to protest, and then the police overreacted, the Labour Party were then put in the position of feeling that they could and should support oppose the protest, the bill that's coming up about what protests will be allowed and not be allowed. And I think the lesson from that is, if you're not happy with the Labour leadership's supine attitude, then you've got to actually protest and push it and force them off the fence. And on this occasion, they have been forced off the fence in the right direction. Better late than never, eh?
Well, we've also got some other elections coming along, which is the Metro Mayor. We haven't really talked much about that. And I'm sure we'll have some of the candidates on this programme in the succeeding weeks. So Metro Mayor is this, I see it as a farcical situation, really, where because the Lib Dem Tory coalition government couldn't get Lib Dem or Tory mayors in many of the cities around the country, they decided to have another mayor, which included tens of thousands of constituents in a big area around the city in the leafy suburbs and the rural areas around the cities in order to make sure they could get either a Lib Dem or most probably a Conservative mayor. And, of course, that's exactly what they did in Bristol with Tim Bowles, the Metro mayor. But for Labour this time, Leslie Mansell did a fantastic job as the candidate 5 years ago as Metro Mayor for the Labour Party from Unison. She is. And even though she very nearly won that, they've decided, no, we're not interested in Leslie Mansell. We're going to get rid of her because she's too left wing, Martin.
Yeah, and Dan Norris is now the Labour candidate for that role. And, of course, he used to be an MP for, I don't know where it was Radstock, wasn't
Wanstyke. It? Wanstyke constituency. Yeah.
And I was looking at the actual votes last time in that election. The first thing to note that the turnout was abysmal. It was 29%. So, in other words, you know, a large proportion of the population didn't engage with it at all. There was basically a three-way split in the vote between Labour, the Liberal Democrats and the Tories. And what must have happened is that Lib Dems switched votes in the second round. You know, it's a two-preference vote. And they switched their votes to the Tories, which pushed them over the line. I imagine that there's going to be a fairly poor turnout this time as well. The same will happen with the police and crime commissioners. The turnout for them was even worse. And, you know, it's quite possible that, you know, any one of the three could win because there's transfer votes there. You know, I think it's quite interesting that, you know, it's hard to analyse because there's a second transfer vote there. But, you know, it's too close to call, I'd suggest.
Well, Martin, I mean, the main issue here is Dan Norris himself, isn't it? Dan Norris is a very interesting character. He was the Labour Party. I mean, I don't know if you were tiptoeing around this issue, but he was a whip for the Labour Party in the House of Commons at the time of the Iraq war vote, wasn't he?
Well, what I know about that was that he was shown a letter, according to my information, had a letter from Tony Blair saying that as far as Blair was concerned,
you're struggling with this a bit.
I'm struggling. I'm trying to remember all the details.
Okay, he got a letter from a constituent, Dan Norris did, making it absolutely clear that this dodgy dossier was just that. There were no weapons of mass destruction, and making it clear that if they were weapons of mass destruction, then they were almost certainly these missing nuclear weapons. So that's what's right, so fascinating about this, that Tony Blair was told, well, if these are, this could be our nuclear weapons that Saddam has got. But he was also saying that he thinks that the whole dossier was cooked up. So Dan Norris had this, showed it to Tony Blair and said, well, why should I be whipping all these MPs around a dodgy dossier that is completely fabricated and made up? So Tony Blair then wrote him a letter, absolutely cast iron, guaranteeing that there really were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and showing it. And in fact, it was discussed in Hansard. I think it was Min Campbell that brought it up in the House of Commons. So it's all there on the record, this letter. And the idea really here is that Dan Norris then had a letter from Tony Blair, which would be absolutely incriminating were he ever brought to trial for an illegal war that he started back in 2003. So where is this letter? I suppose this is the question for Dan. And if you don't have the letter, Dan, how much will you pay for it?
Yes. And I think that's of interest to real political nerds like you and me, Tony. But of course, the main thing about Dan Norris, from a wider point of view, as I said, the turnout's going to be pretty low. The fact is, people know who he is. and that may count for him or against him.
Well, it's a couple of things as well about
how people feel about
Dan. Is he hasn't been seen. I mean, I've spoken to a few Labour people in the area. He's not been seen in Bristol for a decade.
No, well, I mean, but the point is that he is from Radstock. I mean, his family were miners, and he's a known quantity. That may, as I say, mean that people go, well, at least I know who he is. Or people may think, oh, yes, we do know who you are. We're definitely not going to vote for you. We will see. As I say, I think it's going to be a very low turnout. It's going to be very hard to predict who might win it.
Yeah, it's a bit dicey, though, putting, you know, one of the whips for the Iraq war criminal war crime, you know, as their candidate. I think that, you know, they're quite getting quite brazen about who they'll put forward for us to vote.
I think you'll find that both the Tory and the Lib Dem probably weren't involved in politics at that time. But don't forget that they apart from the Lib Dems did have an honourable opposition to the Iraq war. The Conservatives certainly do not. And they've also had Libya, you know, they were the ones who decided to destroy Libya.
Well, we may be coming to that a bit later, but there's another thing to do with Dan, and that is that he has quite, I mean, you know, this just shows us how, I think, the appalling attitude that people standing for office have nowadays. He's wiped all his social media, Martin, so no one knows anything that he's been saying for the last 20 years or so.
Well, that was inevitable going to happen. What's begun, you know, people at one stage...
Well, a lot of candidates don't do that.
Well, they do. I mean, the Tories have actually wiped a load of their stuff from their website.
So that what, the Labour Party people?
Yes, that's right. I mean, if you remember when Kerry McCarthy was elected, I think it was the first time, she was actually the social media czarina for the Labour Party, and she saw the votes. She was allowed in to see the postal votes. And she tweeted after she'd seen it, it looks like I'm ahead in the postal votes. Now, you're not supposed, you are allowed as a candidate to see the postal votes, but you're not allowed to make any comment about where you think you are. But she tweeted it. And of course, she could have been prosecuted for that because it's actually illegal. But I think all the political parties have now realised that the social media is basically a minefield. So anybody who's selected as a candidate, they go through all of their social media posts to see if they can find anything which can be used against them. And therefore, not making any comment is probably the best policy.
Martin, any politician who is covering their tracks, we shouldn't be voting for them. We want to vote for someone who's got a track record that they're prepared to stand for and you know, basically endorse what they've said. You know, the idea that you're going to just wipe out everything or as much as you possibly can that you ever said in case it's used in evidence against you, it just shows utter cowardice.
Well, maybe it does, Tony, but I think all of the political parties, don't forget they've got full-time workers who are designed, you know, that their job is to get their people in. And one of the things, when I spoke to Thangam Debonair, who's the MP for Bristol West, she said, you know, when we were being selected as candidates, they took all the people that might be candidates off to this, you know, away day weekend. And the first thing they said to us, right, they gave us a blank piece of paper and they said, we want you to write down anything we're going to find in social media about you, which might be a count against you in an election campaign. And we want you to put everything down. Because if we find anything on social media that you haven't written down, then you're definitely not going to be one of our candidates.
I mean, this now sounds to me like rule by fear and rule by media. In fact,
well, it is.
It's supposed to be an arbiter of various facts. And then actually what's happening is...
not have any posts at all.
It's being used as a way to basically either character assassinate or not people. So if someone is likely to, for example, sue back, then they might, the media might not criticise them, but if they won't, then they will. I mean, they're becoming, and I suppose maybe to a certain extent they always have been, the kingmakers. But anyway, even if the Labour Party tanks, and there is a great article on the Bristolian talking about the meltdown of confidence in the leadership of the Labour Party under the regional office at the moment, that is Phil Gaskin, Dominic Collins and Hayley Jackson. But the votes are quite likely, Martin, aren't they, as you've said several times, to possibly switch to the Greens. And the Greens also failed to support this vote for a referendum on the mayor. I think anybody that's seen what's happened over the last 10 years in Bristol would say that the mayor system has been a total failure, in that the mayor is very easy to capture by big business interests. And once the mayor begins to work for them, all you see is loads of skyscrapers going up, making people lots of money, and then all the public toilets closing, this sort of thing. Doesn't matter what party they're in. So what do you make of the Greens actually just basically walking away from this opportunity to get rid of the mayor system?
Well, I think they want to, you know, Sandy, I've forgotten his second name now, he wants to be the mayor, doesn't he?
Sandy Hall Rutherford, yeah.
Yeah, he wants to be the mayor. And the people that are pushing for the get rid of the mayor system are the Lib Dems. They're pretty clear that they want to get rid of it. And surprisingly enough, the Tories, because even though it was their idea in the first place. And of course, the reason why the Tories in Bristol and elsewhere want to get rid of the mayor system. And incidentally, Priti Patel is now saying that she's going to bring legislation forward to have first past the post elections for mayors. Because that means that the Tories have got some chance of winning them. In the major cities which have got mayors, the Tories have got no chance of winning in a semi-proportional system. So they're going to gerrymander that as they're going to gerrymander everything else.
Well, Priti Patel is like Queen of the Destroyers. Anything good that happens, she's just stabbing it in the heart.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the Tories are taking their lead from the Republicans in the US, which is as soon as you get any position of power, you then gerrymander the voting system or the constituency boundaries order to make sure you retain it.
Martin, all the candidates, as Labour are doing.
Well, what's happening is in any competitive system, you're going to find people competing within the rules to try and win power and keep it.
Yeah, or outside the rules.
Or outside the rules if they can get away with it.
I mean, this is hardball, isn't it? This is really hardball by dismissing, officers of the various branches around Bristol and saying, well, actually, regional office is going to decide your candidates for you. I mean, that's hardball. It's not the rules.
Well, the rules of the Labour Party are actually quite complicated because it wasn't set up in the first place as a membership party with one member, one vote. It was created, the Labour Representation Committee in the 1900s was a coalition between trade unions and their funds and constituency Labour parties who were, you know, independent socialists. And it was actually a syndicalist structure. So you could be, the cooperative movement was also a part of the structure. And therefore, it was basically a structure set up from different power bases. The Tories, on the other hand, traditionally never had any kind of membership power. The Tory party basically was a ruling class committee set up by the top bods, whoever they were. And then you joined the Tory party and you got told who was your candidate and you got told to vote for them. You didn't have any say in it. The whole idea that parties should have some kind of internal democracy is actually not actually part of the rules. Some parties do have quite big internal democracy, the Greens and the Lib Dems, for example, for their own, you know, because they believe in internal democracy. That's what they have. But there's no particular rule that says that a political party has to have internal democracy. Nigel Farage, as I say, ran the Brexit party as a personal project.
You said that already, and you say it every week. But the idea is, of course, that a political party, to have integrity, does need to have a membership, and it does need to form its policies from the membership at an annual conference. And if it's just a group of people who are being ordered what to say and what to think from top down, you know, the voters will maybe make their own decisions about that if they get a chance to even know about it, because a lot of the mainstream press don't look at things like that at all. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Marvin Rees, the Bristol mayor, at Tuesday's debate. It was a full council where this was debated, this whole business of whether the mayor should be abolished. In fact, they're not going to vote to abolish the mayor. All they were going to vote for was to have a referendum to ask the people of Bristol if we wanted to have a mayor or not. And the Greens voted with the ruling Labour group, at least some of them, in order to to push that down. So there won't be a vote. They want to keep the power. This is the way power goes, isn't it? It corrupts people. So let's have a listen to the Mayor Marvin Rees at Tuesday's meeting, where actually starts off by saying that resources are no object, which is really saying that, you know, it was no problem. We've got plenty of money. Well, if you've got plenty of money, Marvin, then surely you can do things like keep the toilets open. You can pay for disabled kids to be educated and things like that. Anyway, let's have a listen to that now from Tuesday evening.
Resources are the issue. We have phenomenal expertise that is at hand within the city. We've done this with the city office. We've got a policy school at Bristol University that could come down. We've got policy at the University of West of England. We've got business expertise. We can zoom in national experts as well, people who will participate in discussions. Look at what's just happened with the Citizens Assembly. 55 expert contributions to support citizens in coming up with recommendations for what the city does. You know, and in getting elected, people are saying, listen, I'm bringing some expertise, I'm bringing some ability to make things happen. So I think it's a little bit of a false hurdle. When I was working in NHS, we generated loads of interventions and events to tackle mental health inequalities. And many of those things were just mobilising existing resources that were in the city, community power, community engagement. So I'd suggest that actually the field of play in terms of issues and in terms of expertise within the city to draw on is there. It does not need to all go through council officers. I think sometimes we got to make stuff happen ourselves, play ourselves into the game.
So that's Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees there, describing describing politics as a game. You know, he's obviously a game theorist, but he starts off there by talking about saying resource isn't an issue, which I just found extraordinary thing to say when he's always saying that there's just not enough money for this, that and everything else, which is supposed to be a left-wing Labour policy, you know, basically things like social security of various sorts, whether it be social care or educating special educational needs, which has been incredibly cut back financially. I suppose there are some people around that think that you're not getting any money back for that, and they're trying to run Bristol like a business, Martin.
Well, I find it rather extraordinary that he should say that. I mean, I remember going to a demonstration called by Marvin Rees when he was first elected to protest against the government cuts in the central government grant that Bristol gets. And, of course, many other parts of the country, it's local government that bore the brunt of austerity during the Cameron-Osborne era. And it does seem to me rather peculiar that at this stage you should be saying we haven't got a resource problem, which I think is just wrong. It's patently not the case. And it's very bizarre that he should say something like that. I'm a bit taken aback, frankly.
Okay, so also, I mean, this is another criticism from Jo Sargent. Is she saying that there's these various policy groups that Marvin has set up based around the cabinet, which is his hand-picked friends who get paid extra on top of their councillor wages, in order to set policy? And she's saying that that these policies are decided from the top, and if the councillors like them, then they may be part of the clique and may be promoted. But if the councillors, the Labour councillors, that is, don't like them, then Marvin and his friends, what they do is they handpick people from around the city to sit on these boards to actually then make policy in the way he wants. Well, this handpicking policymakers for the city is not democracy.
No, it's not. And I think the problem is the system itself, leaving aside whether Marvin has authoritarian tendencies or not, the system basically allows him to do that. And I don't think that's right. I mean, when Ken Livingstone was originally leader of the GLC back in the 1980s, he was answerable to the Labour group. In actual fact, he initially came to power by a coup inside the Labour group. They'd won the election, and then he was then elected as the leader, even though he hadn't been the leader at the time of the election. And that's when he carried out his most radical policies. And actually, he was then removed from the GLC was abolished. I remember going around there the day it was abolished. It was a crazy situation. Somebody I knew was working there. It was, the whole thing was abolished. Then it was recreated with an elected mayor. And of course, he then stood to be the elected mayor against the Labour candidate and won, and then was readmitted to the Labour Party. But if you asked him today, does he believe in elected mayors? He said, I've never believed in elected mayors. Never. And I don't believe in them either.
OK, so the Councillor Sargent is the fourth councillor to leave the group since March last year, Martin, and they're all either middle or left wingers. None of them are right wingers, and they're certainly not part of Marvin's clique. Eastville representative Sultan Khan defected to the Lib Dems, saying he was tired of infighting within the Labour Party. Harriet Bradley quit her Brislington West seat in July 2020 after being suspended from the Labour Party when it investigated a social media post which was critical of Israel. And then former cabinet member for housing Paul Smith stepped down in September after being appointed chief executive for Elim Housing. Amazingly, the Labour Party member Mike Davis, who seconded this motion to discuss whether to have a referendum on the mayor or not, he wasn't suspended. So it just, I mean, he is, by the way, on the way out, one might say. He won't be standing, I understand, in the next elections. But do you think that there may be a sort of alternative left candidate in these elections? And do they stand any chance, Martin?
Well, I imagine the Socialist Party, the former militant tendency, will stand somebody. But of course they can, because if they get whatever votes they're going to get, I mean, they usually stand. People can then vote Labour as their second choice. If, you know, because there's a transfer vote, it's possible for people to stand as protest candidates, if you like, without messing up and letting through the Tories to run the country. Not the country, I mean the city. But of course, if Priti Patel gets her way and we have first past the post elections for mayors, then you could easily end up with somebody on 10 or 15% of the vote getting all the power that Marvin Rees has now got, and being able to get all of their friends in to do whatever they want, even though they haven't got a majority support of any kind. That's perfectly feasible.
But what about, you've kind of not really answered my question about the idea of having all these hand-picked groups around the mayor and around the cabinet, which go against what a lot of the councillors want. I mean, we're not just talking about opposition councillors, we're talking about Labour councillors as well. This is really an attempt to subvert democracy, isn't it, in Bristol?
Well, if they'd lost, you see, by all of these people resigning or being suspended or whatever, and don't forget that the ward councillors are voted on a first past the post basis. So you've got a basic disjunction between the mayor, which is there is some proportion in there, and the local councillors, you know, because anybody can end up being a local councillor on less than 50% of the vote, as long as the vote is split. But nevertheless, under the old system, once the Labour Party had lost the majority of councillors on the council, then there would quite possibly have to be a change of regime. But of course, Marvin's mandate doesn't derive from those councillors. It derives from a direct vote for the mayor. So he's still in the position of saying, well, I won the last election in Bristol as mayor, and I will carry on doing until somebody comes along who can topple me.
Martin, he didn't, because the last election was cancelled. He's had a free year.
Anyway, so
just to quote from the final thing from Joe Sargent's, really, I mean, I'll put a full copy of this letter, because some of the articles don't include some of the most interesting bits of the letter that have been published. Joe Sargent says, Marvin's response to anyone in the Labour group who disagrees with him is usually something along the lines of, go to your ward and show leadership there. He seems to have no respect for councillors, including Labour ones, other than those in his inner circle. This is so much the case that he set up a whole alternative council to make policy in his city office and subsequent one city boards around the one city plan. It sounds almost like a bit Tolkien-esque, this, doesn't it? The one ring kind of thing. Anyway, she says, she goes on to say, I don't have a problem with the one city plan. Indeed, many of its goals are to be commended. However, I have serious concerns about the way it circumvents democracy, as councillors have been excluded from its creation and development. We're constantly told that we already have platforms and that we shouldn't drown out the voices of ordinary people, even though it is these people who elected us. However, most of the participants in these one city gatherings are people in positions of power, chief executives of businesses, charities and religious leaders. So, you know, she's really saying there that what's going on in Bristol is a complete subversion of the councillor system with a bunch of people handpicked by the mayor.
Yeah, well, that's a problem of the mayoral system or any mayoral system, is that you basically, as the Tories conceived of it, the mayor is basically a CEO of Bristol. And therefore, they're in a position to sack people, appoint people, set up any kind of boards they think are appropriate. And of course, you know, Mayor Ferguson, the previous mayor, was an independent. And, you know, he had the similar powers and he used them in a different way. But it's in the nature of the system, as conceived by the Tories, that it should have this top-down setup. And of course, to some people, especially if they're in that position, as Marvin is, the temptation to use all of those powers is going to be there. I mean, what I would have done if I was Marvin, which I'm not, is I would have said I'm going to rule the city as the leader of the Labour group, and I'm willing to listen to what the Labour group wants, and I will be an executive leader within that context. But of course, you could, if he doesn't want to do that, there's nothing to stop him doing what he's doing, unless, of course, the Liberals get their way and there is a referendum ultimately and the mayoral system is abolished.
I just find it so hilarious that you've got the LibCon coalition from the 2010s that sort of got this whole thing going, and they're now the people leading the charge to get rid of the mayor system.
Well, it is, because obviously, as originally conceived, they hoped it would lead to a situation where the Labour Party would be undermined in various big cities like Bristol, and independents like Ferguson would come forward, and that would undermine the Labour stranglehold. But of course, what's actually happened, Sadiq Khan looks as if he's going to be re-elected in London. You know, Liverpool, it's not clear what's going to happen in Liverpool, actually. You know, they've now, you know, basically, the game has just become what is going to allow us to do what we want.
Yeah, I mean, I mean they do seem to be treating it as a game, as Marvin Rees, the Bristol Mayor, just there said himself. Anyway, one of the consequences of all of this, fiddling whilst Rome is burning, is that we've got a colossal amount of homeless, and many of them have bought vehicles. Some of them are squatting. But there is an increasing number of them getting together, as we saw last week with the eviction up on Gloucester Road of the Pigeon SH1T Collective up there, and a group called Right to Reside, which is forming around, and another one, I think it's called RAT, which we're about to hear about, in London, protesting austerity-led homelessness and campaigning to stop the new Tory anti-trespass law. There's going to be a day of action on Tuesday, the 23rd of March. That's just this coming Tuesday. And it's part of pro-Israel Home Secretary Priti Patel's police crime sentencing and courts bill. And it's been rolled into that. So this whole business of trespassing was going to be a separate bill to be separately debated, but they decided to just cut and paste it into a much wider anti-protest bill, changing the sentencing and the courts. And of course, the courts are already on their knees with a massive, massive backlog. You know, interesting that they say that there's no problem with money, except they can't pay for justice. You know, this is this gangster terminology. This is another thing that's, I mean, just going back to the Bristol story, is this whole idea of someone's got a vendetta against the mayor. This is gangster language. Actually, these people have tried to stick with the mayor as long as they can until they've been bullied out. And there's four of them now. So anyway, Priti Patel's police crime sentencing and courts bill will criminalise hundreds of thousands of travellers and other homeless people. I mean, this includes gypsies, obviously, as well, across the UK this year if it's passed. The law is also set to ban protests. So there's a protest against this every Saturday now starting tomorrow until the government backs down at College Green in Bristol. I think it starts at noon, but I'm not absolutely sure about that. Anyway, some groups are saying that we're going to be protesting against this law until it finishes. until it's voted down on College Green every Saturday. But what they're doing, Martin, though, of course, is turning hundreds of thousands of Britain's poorest into criminals. Do you think Priti Patel will get her civil war? Because that's where it's what she seems to want.
Well, it's very provocative, isn't it? And, of course, she's bringing it through now while COVID restrictions are still in place, so that the police, for example, can say, normally we'd accept a protest like this, but because of COVID restrictions, we won't. So, you know, they're basically making permanent COVID restrictions going forward in a situation where people can't protest against those restrictions because of the lockdown.
It does rather make you think that you could be right in you talking about, you know, this whole idea of a police state being ushered in under the cover of the lockdowns.
Well, I don't think it's just the lockdown is the lockdown. It's a separate issue. But the idea that there is a police state, I mean, I've been reading this week about further revelations from the inquiry into the spy cops whatever it is.
Crimes. These were crimes.
Yes, it is. I mean, basically, we have had in this country for many years, effectively, a political Stasi. If you've ever been involved in any political campaigning of any kind, you can be quite certain that you have probably run into undercover police officers who have been gathering information about you and also possibly leading to situations where you've been denied work, or you've found yourself discriminated against in other ways. And also, of course, they've formed relationships with numbers of people and had children with them, all of which is totally illegal, but they've done it.
Getting between the sheets with people who haven't even necessarily committed any crime at all.
Well, the fact is that they didn't bother to infiltrate major drug gangs or terrorist groups. We're talking about what are essentially legitimate political protest groups have been completely, the state's been all over them with taxpayer money, of course.
Now, I mean, we've had stuff about this in previous weeks. We were looking at the whole blacklisting issue, the idea that there are these databases of people we don't like, rather like the Chinese social credit system, where they have a basically profile of all their population, of the goodies and the baddies, and the people that have got minds of their own get put on the baddies list and bullied and lose their jobs, possibly get arrested, possibly get their homes infiltrated, their lives hacked by police spies, etc. But what have you been finding out about this spy cops issue this week, Martin?
Well, it's coming out in dribs and drabs. And, of course, this whole inquiry would never have taken place if activists themselves hadn't uncovered Mark Kennedy. And then the Guardian journalists picked up on it and started chasing it up. And eventually they've been forced to put this inquiry in place. But this inquiry has already basically said it's not really going to look into all of the details of everything that went on. That the inquiry is being used as a cover-up, effectively. But on the other hand, even the tiny details that are leaking out are absolutely shocking to those who imagine that they live in a democracy in this country, because they targeted overwhelmingly what you might call the progressive left wing in politics. There was some minimal infiltration of right wing groups and no infiltration at all of criminal groups. They didn't even bother looking after people who are bringing large amounts of drugs into the country or trying to smuggle weapons. They don't use undercover stuff for that. This is all completely directed. It's a political police operating at a political level. And the thing that came out this week is that the special demonstration squad based in the Met was actually under the orders of MI5. So all of this was basically MI5 using police officers as the foot soldiers.
Fascinating. Well, I wonder if these this is the problem, of course. We're having a half-cock inquiry, which is what they love to do, is that these individuals within the security services, within special branch, within the special demonstration squad, or whatever they've renamed it to now, could still well be operating with these present groups, people like Extinction Rebellion, Black Lives Matter, the groups I was just telling you about, you know, RAT, the London group, the Right to Reside group, Antifa. I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean, the groups which are promoting violence against women, this could all still be happening, couldn't it?
Well, I think it almost certainly is still happening. And of course, it couldn't be clearer because the government has just passed bills which are going to become law with their 80-seat majority on 43% of the vote, which are going to make any illegal action by the security services, by the police, by the military, as beyond punishment.
OK, so what you're saying is that rather than just sleeping with activists, these agents might well be able to kill them with impunity.
Well, in Northern Ireland, lots of people have been killed with impunity. No doubt about it. The bombs in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, the explosives were supplied by British intelligence. Killed 27 people. Has anybody been prosecuted? No, they haven't. Will they be? No, they won't. That's the democracy we live in.
Anyway, lots of these groups are springing up as these more draconian laws chug through. It'd be very interesting to see what the police's take is on all this, you know, as to whether they decide they want to try and clamp down hard on these various protest movements or whether they see it as a little bit more nuanced than that, where they will only stop demonstrations where there is violence, etc. Because there's obviously no real excuse, Martin, for the police to wade in on the vigil taking place against a police officer, police officer is alleged to have killed Sarah Everard, and the police decide to weigh in mob handed last Saturday night. There's been a bit of a backlash against that. But, I mean, where do you draw the line when it comes to what you police and what you don't? A vigil, I don't think I've ever seen in this country police weighing into vigils before.
Well, I mean, obviously they would claim that it's because of the COVID restrictions, etc. But I understand that the local police in Clapham had come to an arrangement with the protesters about what was going to happen. And then they were overruled from the top.
Well,
and it looks like
Patel. There was a discussion in court about it. And the court judge decided that this was going to be an illegal demonstration or illegal vigil. And therefore, that if anyone turned up as marshals to try and make sure everyone was safe, socially distanced, had masks and things like that, that they could be charged with organising a demonstration, potentially arrested and potentially fined up to £10,000 for just being there. So it was obvious that things were going to start to go wrong from that judge's decision from that point on, where there is a demonstration that's been organised, a vigil that's been organised. Loads of people are obviously deciding to go. And at the last minute on the radio, they're told, oh, this is cancelled now. But lots of people, of course, did turn up, but there was actually no organisation of it whatsoever. It seems to me that the whole thing was a setup, that this judge was actually, he knew, he must have known, or she must have known, that he was going to cause absolute chaos trying to close this demonstration down at the last minute.
Well, in Birmingham, there was a vigil, which was arranged by word of mouth with the police. It took place, it lasted an hour, and everybody went home and nobody was arrested.
Same in Bristol, yeah.
Yeah. So in other words, what we've got is a very inconsistent system, which very much depends upon who's in charge on the day and what they think or don't think is right. It reminds me of when we were actually outside Downing Street when George Bush came to visit Tony Blair, and we were all standing behind barriers outside Downing Street, and this one guy started going mad and throwing the barrier around and trying to egg everybody on to try and storm Downing Street. I was standing not very far away from where this was happening, and most people were just, you know, a bit taken aback by what was happening. And then somebody standing next to me pointed and said, I know who that is. That is a police inspector, because I met him at a party on Saturday night. And they said, I know his name. He told me his name. And in actual fact, there was a formal complaint made by Stop the War to the police about that. And it did transpire that the guy who was trying to start a riot was, in fact, a police inspector in North London. And he was there as an agent provocateur. Now, to my mind, that should have been the end of his police career. But it wasn't.
Yeah, well, absolutely right. So the most extraordinary thing about the Clapham Common vigil was the turning up of the Duchess of Cambridge. I mean, I think she did a pretty good job there, just laid some flowers, had a chat with some of the people, stayed for about half an hour and then went off before it got dark. Of course, things then started to kick off afterwards, Martin. And the big irony here, well, I mean, it's a horrendous irony, isn't it? That here is a vigil held for a woman who's allegedly been killed by a a diplomatic and royal protection officer, murdered by her, by him. And actually, it may even be that Kate Middleton may have even known the face of this guy. This is the sort of guy that would be protecting diplomats and possibly royals too.
Well, I think what it does is it dramatises quite openly, doesn't it, what we're, all the issues that we're talking about here. I mean, Kate Middleton, or Windsor as she now is, came along because it's a widely supported protest. Lots of people understand why it's there. It, to my mind, what the Met Police should have done there, they should have talked to the protest organisers and tried to arrange that it was done according to COVID regs, and then everybody could have had their protest and gone home, and that would have been the end of it.
Yeah, well,
but instead, of course, it's dramatised.
Martin, that was never going to happen.
About the way things are going.
That was never going to happen from the moment that the organisers were threatened with arrest and massive fines.
No, but I mean, don't forget that, for example, last year in Bristol, we had the protest which ended up with Colston in the dock, literally in the dock in the harbour. And of course, in what this bill that Priti Patel's put forward, you can get 10 years for doing that, apparently. You don't get 10 years for rape, but you get 10 years for defacing a statue. And this, of course, is all part of culture wars. The local elections are coming up, and the right wing of the Tory party is trying to whip up what is essentially a crypto-fascist culture war against all the people they don't like.
Trying to out-crypto-fascist the Labour Party.
Well, the Labour Party are lamely going along with the Tory strategy, because Keir Starmer believes that it is his role to win back the red wall voters who voted for Johnson at the last election, because he still thinks that he can win under first past the post, which he can't. And, his whole strategy has basically been wrong, in my view. What he should be doing is reaching out to other progressive forces, not bending over backwards to keep, you know, some fairly reactionary people happy.
Okay, well, the
never going to vote Labour anyway.
The other interesting aspect of the Wayne Cousins, alleged murder by Wayne Cousins of Sarah Everard, is is this guy who's his boss, Assistant Commissioner Neil Basu, much loved by MI5. Apparently MI5 it was that got him the job as the anti-terror boss. He's still not been on TV explaining how one of his officers became a potential murderer, Martin. Now, these are the people who are supposed to be protecting us against terrorists.
Well, I don't think we can make too... I mean, the fact that an individual police officer has got tendencies which lead him to carry out sexual murder... that you can't really protect, you know, people are like that.
Let's just be careful here, because it's all very alleged.
The other, yes, that's right, thing, and he's not even been convicted.
The other alleged thing is that apparently he exposed himself at a kebab shop 3 days previous to Sarah's abduction, allegedly, if it's the same person, and we just don't know, it certainly looks like that. And nothing was done about it. So they had CCTV, they reported it to the police, etc., and nothing happened. I mean, surely the guy should have been just arrested straight away, even if he was a police officer.
Yeah, one would have thought so. But of course, as you well know, Tony, I mean, people exposing themselves is not uncommon. Lots of people do it, and it doesn't necessarily end up in court immediately. But if the fact that he was a police officer, I think they should have picked up on that.
Well, yeah. I would have thought so.
If
the police had done their job on that occasion, it would have meant that he would certainly have not had any access to firearms. He would have had his warrant card taken away, because there's also an accusation that he used his warrant card to gain the confidence of Sarah. That's only allegedly.
Yes. And I think, you know, it may be just that they messed up, that they didn't look at the CCTV in time or whatever. But really, that does raise questions about how professional they are. If a police officer exposes himself in a fast food shop, his feet shouldn't touch the floor, should they?
I wouldn't have thought so. Yeah, he should be fast in the back, Mariah.
I suppose if he'd done it in uniform, then they really would have had to arrest him. I presume he didn't do it in uniform.
Well, we don't.
But nevertheless, I don't think we can presume he did it or out.
We can't presume he did it, and we certainly can't presume he did it in or out of uniform. We just don't know, or if he did it at all. So I think on the positive side of all this, I think one of the most amazing things is that Priti Patel seems to be succeeding in bringing all these different protest groups together that she's trying to ban. You know, we're talking about Extinction Rebellion. We're talking about the massive anti-lockdown demonstrations. We're talking about Black Lives Matter, and now we're talking about Antifa too, and this kind of new group really, which is coming up around, I mean, although they've always been there, around the right to reside, stopping people, basically the idea of criminalising travellers, which, by the way, is against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, as is the idea of banning protests, also against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It seems that Priti Patel, sitting in her office at the Home Office, just crossing off various of the articles in the Charter of Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So anyway, next Tuesday, there is going to be some sort of a protest around the country. Certainly London seems to be one of the places where it's happening. People are protesting against this whole idea of criminalising the homeless, criminalising the poor, criminalising travellers and gypsies. And I spoke earlier this week to someone from the Bristol's Right to Reside group called Dara.
Hi, so I'm Dara, and these new laws have proposed to change trespass from a civil offence to a criminal offence. And what they're doing is they're not just changing the law of trespass from a civil to a criminal offence. They've specified that this is trespass with the intent to reside, and they've aimed this at traveller communities, intent to reside with one or more vehicles. And I think it's really important that people start talking about how these laws aren't in place to protect landowners. There's already plenty of laws in place to protect landowners. These laws are in place to stop protests and to stop travelling communities, or Roma Gypsy and traveller communities, from living their lifestyles. There's been a whole plethora of laws throughout history to try and like quieten these minority voices and their ways of life, and this is like the sort of final straw to that, I guess, you know.
There's
like,
only a few people live in vehicles, very few this is going to affect. Surely this is more to do with, I mean, when people think about trespassing, they're thinking about maybe straying off a footpath on a country walk.
Yeah, but what they've specified in this is about people in vehicles. The law officially states that this is trespass with the intent to reside in a vehicle will be criminalised. They've even put out a statement saying that wild campers and roamers won't be persecuted in this. Priti Patel has squeezed these laws. So the trespass laws, originally the intent to criminalise trespass, was not part of this courts and sentencing bill that Priti Patel is putting forward. It was a separate matter. There was a Nick Hayes and the Right to Roam organisation made a petition which got enough signatures for the criminalisation of trespass to be debated in court, but they've managed to sneakily, pushed it back because of coronavirus, delayed, that's the word, they've delayed the debate on it so much that now they've managed to just sneak it through as part of this bill, when before it was actually separate, and now they're not even going to debate it in reference to this petition and all of these voices saying, we do not agree with this, we do not agree with the criminalisation of trespass. In the last MP letter that was written to MPs, and their response to it was basically saying that the public will disrupt land, the public will pollute land, and if we just give open access to people to our green spaces, it will be destroyed. And our reaction to this is, we already have corporations and businesses abusing our wild spaces. We don't have access to these spaces. If you give people domain over space, they will look after it. And right now our British countryside is already being abused, and it has no, like, you know, the people are not affecting this, it's the corporations doing this. Yeah, I mean, you can sort of see this bill as an extension to the Criminal Justice and Public Order Bill and what Thatcher did, and she ruined the housing market, none of us had anywhere to live. And I mean, a lot of our parents, especially the new traveller scene, you know, that was, we've all grown up in this new traveller generation, but our parents were forced out of civilised society to live in vans and vehicles because they couldn't afford housing, and we still can't afford housing. I think they will succeed in getting this bill passed, unfortunately, but hopefully get the message out, get public understanding of how these laws are actually a direct attack on traveller Roma and gypsy communities. This isn't about landlords. Just sort of change the rhetoric around this law in the public eye, I think, is the most important thing now, so we can get more of a backing and more of a resistance against this. It's absolutely insane. The idea that you can make someone a trespass just by existing in a space is just insane and really horrible to think about, really. But, you know, that's where we've got to. Well, we've got RAT in London, which is Resisting Anti-Trespass London. I believe they're trying to stir some stuff up for the 23rd. There's a whole group of independents in Bristol trying to get something together and try and get the word out about these laws. I guess it's all a bit decentralised and lots of individuals working in small groups, not wanting to be named, but also wanting to be able to protest. Because also, you know, part of this bill is the criminalisation of protest itself, or any protest that causes disruption, which is a massive issue, because the whole point of protest is generally to cause disruption and air our grievances. But if we can only do that in a regulated set time and set place, we're not really protesting at all, are we?
Well, that's Dara there from Right to Reside in Bristol, Martin. Lovely to hear these youngsters kind of getting into, I suppose, what we were doing and when we were at their age too, which is saying, look, you know, we're not having this effectively. The end of the megaphone, that's another thing which is part of this. Apparently, if you've got a megaphone, it's going to have to be turned right down at a demonstration. Otherwise, you will be instantly arrested and you will become a criminal.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? Because I remember a few years ago now, we had a protest outside a conference which had been organised by BAE Systems about drones. And this was when drones were just coming into public consciousness as being used for assassinations and murders in foreign countries. Anyway, we turned up outside the place in the centre of Bristol where they were having this conference in the conference centre. And the police talked to us about what we wanted to do. We said, we want to have a protest. They said, OK, you can come and protest. They put us outside. And we had lots of really noisy protesters. There was Rita Lynch's band. There was a sound system. And there was lots of people banging pots and pans. And as a result of the noise that we were making, they had to cancel the conference. And it was shown on ITV West. It was shown of all these people just scurrying out of the back door and being sent off. And they'd come from all over the world. They had to take them off and put them on planes and send them all the way back. And the police took the line at that stage that there's no, I mean, they were complaining like mad, saying we can't have our conference in here. They're too noisy. And the police were saying, well, there's no law about being noisy on demonstrations. And if you think about it, it's quite extraordinary that the police can decide how much noise you can make on a demonstration. The whole point of demonstrations often is for people to shout and chant and all the rest of it.
Well, yeah,
the police going to be able to say you can't do that?
Attract the attention of the public around so they can come and pick up a leaflet and find out what it's all about, that sort of thing. I mean, it seems to me that there's an attempt to get the entire national narrative either happening on the floor of the House of Commons or on the supine national media, things like Question Time, which is like, you know, watching paint dry these days. There's a total attempt to shut discussion, public discussion, down about a whole load of issues, and in fact many issues that don't even get talked about at all, like this actually riding a coach and horses through the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Yes, and at the same time, you've got the right wing of the Tory party going on about the woke mobs who are trying to silence the voices of people who disagree with them, etc. I mean, basically, they are total hypocrites. They want to be the only people whose voices are heard. And anybody else who speaks out of line from their point of view is going to be criminalised. Now, you can go down that road, and of course the gerrymandering they're going to carry through is another straw in the wind, and preventing people from voting unless they've got photo ID. This sounds very like Northern Ireland before 1969. And of course that ended up with two Tory prime ministers nearly murdered and ultimately a peace agreement. Pity Patel is playing with fire.
Yes, she is. Extinction Rebellion have accused the Tories of trying to create an authoritarian police state.
Well, I mean, they're quite right, aren't they? I mean, basically, the right to protest and have a say is fundamental. And if you haven't got it, how can you win over people to your point of view? And of course, what they're doing on every level is trying to create what is effectively a one-party Tory state, specifically in England. Because, of course, the Scots We were talking earlier about the right to roam. In Scotland, people have had the right to roam over any part of the land for many years because it was passed through the Scottish Parliament as one of the causes that John Smith, former Labour leader, held dear to his heart. And you can see the political culture of Scotland and England diverging on this. And of course, in Northern Ireland, they wouldn't dare to try and produce this kind of stuff because it's too explosive. You can't mess around with this kind of thing because ultimately, if you force people out of the political system, they'll find some way to kick their way back in.
There's an article by Michael East about it's to do with, you know, whether or not the police are part of the problem or part of the solution, really. It's the headline is, "The problem with police criminality in the UK is much bigger than you think. A list of crimes committed by serving police officers between 2009 and 2021 is absolutely horrific," he says. And he points to a database which has been put together of these various police crimes. The first page of the document, he says, already brings us our first allegation of murder, with PC Timae Bremer accused of killing his lover. Despite admitting he strangled her, he was found not guilty of murder. It is one of 12 counts of homicide since 2009, with the killing of Sarah Everard not even included. 10 of these murders are of women, 2 are of black men, and 9 victims were the police officer's wife or girlfriend. 1 was his daughter. I think we've got a bit of a problem in the police, Martin, that needs clearing up here. Rather than, you know, putting all men in the country on curfew, they should just go through the police officers already there and make sure they don't have any murderers or potential murderers in their midst.
Well, as you will remember, a part of the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland was the disbanding of the Royal Ulster Constabulary as a sectarian police force and its reconstitution as the Police Service of Northern Ireland, which was going to be independent of political pressure from loyalists or from the British government. And don't forget, many RUC men and women were actually casualties of the war. They were also, of course, involved in setting up murders of people they didn't like Pat Finucane. Priti Patel, her family came here from Uganda in the 1970s. And this authoritarianism that she seems to be very keen on has got the potential to plunge mainland Britain into what the people of Northern Ireland went through for 30 years. And if she thinks, for example, if we're going to have mass unemployment, which we quite likely are this year, next year, and you're going to have lots of military age males hanging around with no money, the potential for extreme violence is very much there, especially if the police become a distrusted enemy force in inner city areas.
Well, we had, didn't we, a piece a couple of months ago on the Clydach murders in South Wales, one of the most horrific murder cases in recent Welsh history. I think it was 1999 it happened, where there were 3 murders of various different generations. Midnight on the Saturday, extreme violence was unleashed on Mandy Power, her 80-year-old mother Doris, and Mandy's children, Katie, aged 10, and Emily, aged 8. All 4 were beaten to death. And the embarrassing part of that is that many people are pinning this actually on a police officer and that was involved with the family, that Di Morris, or David Morris, has been serving a life sentence, later reduced to 32 years. So he's still in jail. He could have been released by now, Di Morris, but he said, "I'm not going to say I was guilty," and then get it out early. He won't do that, and he's going to carry on fighting for his release. So, you know, if in South Wales, the most horrific murder of recent years, as it looks like, was actually carried out by the police, Martin, we've absolutely got to have some sort of accountability so that the decent police who are now serving, I feel a little bit like it's a bit like journalism, actually, where decent journalists have to be backed up, whilst the dodgy ones, the ones who are lying, and the criminal police officers have got to be rooted out. Is it ever going to happen?
Well, this has been there's always going to be a tension about this, because the police do have extensive powers and they're open to abuse. I mean, the West Midlands police force was ultimately disbanded and reconstituted as the West Mercia police, because they had a reputation for just beating people up in custody and fitting them up, including the Birmingham Six. And, you know, there's always been tension about this. And you know, I lived in Brixton during the early 1980s. And frankly, the police at that stage were completely unprofessional. Both of the riots were largely caused by the unprofessional behaviour of the police. And the danger is that if unprofessional behaviour by the police is given encouragement, like that inspector that I spoke about earlier, who was trying to foment a riot, that's what he was trying to do. If those people aren't punished, then the whole thing becomes very, very out of control very, very quickly. And if people don't think that they could have, you know, major riots in this country with lots of people killed, as we see in the United States of America, if they can't see that that can happen here, then they haven't got enough imagination. It's quite possible that we could go down that road. If you've got a very, very hardline Tory government, as we now have, mass unemployment, and there is going to be a potential flare-up, which, and of course, if the police are perceived to be the heavy hand of that Tory government by a younger generation, then the possibilities for extreme violence are definitely there.
Well, anyway, RAT, which is Resist Anti-Trespass, and the Right to Reside group, etc., are very new groups. And so what I'll do is I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk if you're interested in seeing what they're up to. More power to their elbow, I say. The idea that, you know, you don't resist an authoritarian clampdown is just a no-brainer, as far as I'm concerned. So that's it for the first part, Martin. We're going to be looking at the extraordinary events with the withdrawal of the Russian ambassador from Washington. I was looking out for it on the news last night. Apparently it wasn't news. You know, this is the first time this has happened, and it's absolutely extraordinary. But this is a bit embarrassing, isn't it, for the elites, that it looks like there may be a war looming with Russia, but they don't want to talk about it. And that's the way the mass media operates nowadays. So thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers for the first hour. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.
and seems to be called Sly Ed. I mean, Sly hyphen Ed. It's by the man with no name on Dragonfly Records.
Yeah, that's not me back announcing that. A hat tip to the ravers of the 1990s. And as Dara was saying there, you know, this is definitely a pickup from the banning of the right to party that was going on in the Criminal Justice Act in the 1990s. So, yeah, more power to the elbow of the raver. Sly Ed, the man with no name there. Martin, this is an opportune moment, I suppose, to look at the international news that's hardly been reported yesterday, which is this incredible situation with the Russians withdrawing their ambassador to Washington with virtually zero comment on the main news bulletins about it.
I think it's the first time they've ever done it. There was a Russian ambassador still resident in the United States throughout the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, yes, of course, the Soviet
ambassador. Yeah. Of course, we've got to be clear that there's a distinction. It's not clear whether they're permanently withdrawing their ambassador. He's been withdrawn for consultations because of the interview that Joe Biden gave to George Stephanopoulos. If you actually read the transcript of the interview, it's truly astonishing because Biden basically says that Putin's a killer, which even if it's true, it's not really diplomatic language. You could say George Bush is a killer, but it's not the sort of thing that you would say, if you were a president.
Well, no, and also Biden has made it absolutely clear that he wants to reset good diplomacy with Russia. And there he is. The other thing, of course, he said, and we'll hear the clip in a minute, is he's saying that Putin has got no soul.
I thought that was extraordinary from Joe.
Yeah, amazing.
Joe Biden claims that he had a one-on-one meeting with Putin.
Yeah.
Where he said to Putin, but I think you've got no soul. And then Putin supposedly said, we understand each other. Now, do you know what, Tony? I don't believe a word of that. But in any case, for Joe Biden to claim, Biden claims to be a Catholic. Now, it's Catholic doctrine that everybody has got a soul. So the idea that Putin has got no soul is... it flies in the face of Catholic teaching, for starters.
It certainly does.
It's an extraordinary thing to say. I mean, they're going out of their way to flick Putin's nose.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. And, of course, what also people need to realise is a massive NATO exercise going on in the Black Sea at the moment. The Russians are basically squaring up to a huge, a fleet of is pouring into the Black Sea, and at the same time the Ukrainian government is pouring tanks and heavy weaponry onto the front lines with the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. So what may well happen here very soon, rather than in the medium term, is a massive fight in Ukraine and in the Black Sea. And, of course, if it happens, it could easily spin out of control and we could end up with a full-on war with Russia.
Well,
there doesn't seem to be any sense on the American side that they see this as a danger at all.
Extraordinary that Joe Biden thinks that he's like the Pope, you know, that he can decide who's got a soul and who hasn't.
I think he's just, he's just talking out of his backside, frankly. I don't even believe that.
It was also quite amazing to see George Stephanopoulos at ABC News actually just basically feeding him. I mean, what every journalist is told never to do, which is to say, saying things like, do you think that Putin's a killer? And then Biden says, yes. So the idea is basically the line is not Biden's line. It's George Stephanopoulos' line. And this reminds me very much of the Day-to-Day series with Chris Morris, who, by the way, I worked with for a few months back in 1991, Great London Radio. And his thing, which was about these news readers starting a war. Well, this is what could possibly be happening. Thank you very much, George Stephanopoulos. So let's have a listen now anyway to, we got a couple of clips with that, one about Afghanistan, but we're going to start with the interview of George Stephanopoulos at ABC as he talks to Joe Biden about Putin this week.
Director of National Intelligence came out with a report today saying that Vladimir Putin authorized operations during the election to denigrate you, support President Trump, undermine our elections, divide our society. What price must he pay?
He will pay a price. We had a long talk, he and I. I know him relatively well. And the conversation started off, I said, I know you and you know me. If I establish this occurred, then be prepared.
You said you know he doesn't have a soul.
I did say that to him, yes. And his response was, we understand one another. I wasn't being a wise guy. I was alone with him in his office. That's how it came about. It was when President Bush had said, I've looked in his eyes and saw a soul. I said, looked in your eyes, and I don't think you have a soul. And looked back at me and said, we understand each other. Look, most important thing dealing with foreign leaders, in my experience, and I've dealt with an awful lot of them over my career, is just know the other guy.
So you know Vladimir Putin. You think he's a killer?
Mm-hmm. I do.
So what price must he pay?
The price he's going to pay, well, you'll see shortly. I'm not going to, by the way, we ought to be able, that trite expression, walk and chew gum at the same time. There are places where it's in our mutual interest to work together. That's why I renewed the START agreement with him. That occurred while he's doing this. But that's overwhelming in the interest of humanity that we diminish the prospect of a nuclear exchange.
Well, in his comedy program, The Day to Day, Chris Morris says, well, they're obviously invading the country. What are you going to do about it? And there's this poor politician is sort of bamboozled into saying, well, yes, OK, I think it's going to have to be war. You could not make this stuff up. There he is, George Papadopoulos, twice, Martin, egging on the president, the new president Biden, Sleepy Joe, to say, what price must he pay? Come on, Joe, what price must he pay?
Yeah, Stephanopoulos, not Papadopoulos, but yes. Well, I think it's a setup by the handlers of Biden and Stephanopoulos. They are basically upping the rhetoric against the Russians. They're claiming, for example, that they interfered in the election. Well, there's zero evidence of that, but never mind. It doesn't matter. It's evidence-free, all of this. They're also claiming that the
Just hang on there, because the evidence is, isn't it, that actually it was internal interference in that election by the Democratic Party itself and others, because they're trying basically to put the blame onto Russia for something that was going on internally in the US.
Well, that's right. There is massive security service intervention in US elections, but it's not the FSB, it's the CIA, and it always has been. I mean, if you think about it, even if the Russians wanted to influence a US election, they could barely get a word in edgeways behind all the millions and billions that are spent on both sides of the fence in the US to try and bamboozle their way to power. I mean,
well,
it's just
absurd. If you think the CIA were fixing elections, how?
The CIA, basically, or the deep state, if you want to call it that, are behind who gets chosen to be the candidates in the first place. So that's why we've ended up with Joe Biden, because they basically broke the legs of Bernie Sanders and ended the political career of Tulsi Gabbard, who's now retired from politics. But Biden was chosen by the deep state as the least worst option to keep Trump out because they didn't like Trump. And, of course, Biden is now doing exactly what he's supposed to do. He's not even a marionette. He's a glove puppet. And he's just coming out with what they want, which is they want a big confrontation with Russia, because a confrontation with Russia implies big bucks for the military-industrial complex. If you're fighting various ragtag rebels in Afghanistan or whatever, then there's no big spending involved in that. Whereas if we're going to take on the Russians, we're going to need new tanks, planes, aircraft carriers, what have you. But it's very dangerous because, the Russians may at some point just decide, well, they already have decided there's not much point talking to you, so we're going to stop talking to you. And when we react to what you do, we won't be flagging it up. We're just going to do it. And of course, the other thing they've claimed is that they carried out a cyber attack, the SolarWinds cyber attack on various institutions in the US. And they've openly said, we are going to carry out a cyber attack on Russia in the next 3 weeks. Now, you have to point out that cyber attacks are illegal. So the US has said, we're going to carry out an illegal cyber attack on Russia. And of course, the Russians are preparing their defences for that. And they're basically preparing for war. They'd be fools if they didn't. If the Ukrainians decide that they're going to try a blitzkrieg to reconquer the East Ukraine, then that will be potentially the trigger for World War III. Meanwhile, Priti Patel is wondering whether we should get rid of travellers.
The idea of a cyber attack, actually, the NATO countries said that if there is a cyber attack on them, they will consider it an act of war.
They would, yes. And of course, they carried out, the Israelis and the Americans carried out a cyber attack on the Iranians, the Stuxnet attack, which caused all kinds of problems inside Iran, totally illegal under international law, as was Joe Biden's airstrike on Iraqi government forces at a checkpoint into Syria the other week. In other words, they are already, and of course, they now the British have now sent our aircraft carrier to the South China Sea to flick the nose of Xi Jinping. This is quite likely in the short, you know, we could be at war with Iran, Russia and China before the summer. And, you know, meanwhile, Keir Starmer's trying to win over the Red Wall. By waving the Union Jack.
Well, I mean, when Biden says you will see shortly what price Putin will pay, I can't help but thinking he hasn't got a clue what's going on, and someone else will be deciding what price Putin will pay, if at all.
I think that's absolutely right. I don't think Biden is making decisions at all. He's very much a front for the for other forces. You know, John F. Kennedy faced down his military. If you watch the film 13 Days in May, I think it's called, it was a Hollywood film. So I thought I'll watch it, see if it's any good. And it was very good, because basically Kennedy had to face down his own military, who was saying, why don't we destroy the world? Press the button.
Well, that's right.
We're not going to do that.
It was Curtis Lee May and General Power at Strategic Air Command. They had decided, without actually consulting with anybody else, really, that there had to be a nuclear war in order to stop the increasing missile gap, which the Russians were catching up with them in the number of nuclear warheads they had. And they said, well, if we don't take them out now, they're going to catch up with us.
Yes, and of course, what's happened this week is that the Tory government here has decided to increase our missile capacity by 40%. Apparently, there's no money to pay nurses, but we can increase our nuclear missiles by 40%. Now, in actual fact, from the Russian point of view, it makes no difference at all. They've modernized their nuclear forces recently, and they're in a position to incinerate anybody who attacks them. So, you know, the whole point of deterrence is to have enough to deter people. You don't need any more than that. The Chinese, for example, have stopped their missile. You know, they've got several hundred missiles. They could. I mean, the Russians have got something like 4,500. The Americans about 3,800. So Britain having 180 in terms of that is neither here nor there. Britain's missiles will be enough to destroy the entire world.
Martin, we did hear last week, didn't we, that the Chinese have got some satellite, and I would imagine the Russians and the Americans have got some similar type of system, which can actually identify and locate these submarines, which for many decades have been able to sort of sneak along the seabed very quietly. Looks now as if using these new satellites equipped with some kind of laser, which can shoot through the laser doesn't do the shooting. It just fires down through the sea, apparently, and picks these submarines out so that they can be located and destroyed by missiles. So, you know, one does wonder what on earth would happen if there is actually an exchange. I do think, though, that a lot of this is saber rattling. The idea here is to get everyone afraid.
Well, I think you're right. I don't think, I mean, what was clear in 1962 was that they really were mad enough to blow everybody up. The US military really are that crazy. And that was absolutely clear. The only thing that stopped them in the end was Kennedy's determination that that was not going to happen. And he deserves his heroic status just for that. And he basically opened negotiations with the Russians through his brother, Robert F. Kennedy, who was also assassinated, where they agreed that the Americans would withdraw their missiles from Turkey quietly, and then the Russians would withdraw their missiles from Cuba openly, and they would say that they'd done it because they didn't want to go to war, etc. But really, the deal was that the Americans would withdraw their missiles from Turkey. But what the Soviets had agreed was that they wouldn't crow about that, that they wouldn't say anything about it. So, in other words, a kind of understanding between the two sides started to develop from that point. But when you've got, basically a senile man with his finger on the nuclear football in the US, and all of this kind of absolutely over-the-top rhetoric about the Russians. The Russians are about to have a democratic election in September this year. It's going to go ahead as normal, as it normally does, as it has done since the changes over there, and it's quite likely that Putin's party are going to win. And that's the reality. Modern Russia is more democratic than the United States of America. It's all very well the Americans say, yes, but we invented democracy, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, but what you've got now is a dog's breakfast of a mess.
Yeah, well,
what they've got in Russia is, in fact, a functioning democracy.
They haven't got democracy, and neither have we. The other thing which is striking is the popularity of the government and the popularity of the individual leaders is appalling in the West, whereas actually Putin is genuinely liked. People vote for him. They're not in the situation in Russia where they're having to think, oh, these are an absolute dog's breakfast here. Who is the least bad to vote for?
Yeah, because it's actually a proportional vote. And, of course, the presidential vote is a trans, you know, you've got to get 50% to become the president. But the elections to the Duma are proportional, and you will get a full spectrum of opinions in that Duma. The far right will be in there, Zhirinovsky, who are much more extreme than Putin. United Russia will be in there. They are like old style moderate conservatives, if you like. And then you've got the Communist Party, which will also be in there. And there's another left wing party called Justice or Fairness for Russia. And they'll be in there. I tell you who probably won't be in there is the pro-Navalny type parties, because they won't reach 5% of the
what
vote.
What about Alexei Navalny? You're not going to see anything of him, are we?
Because they've never reached 5% of the vote. They're
so
presented in the West as if they're the major
anyway.
Opposition. The major opposition in Russia to Putin comes from the Communist Party. So during the constitutional referendum last year, which Putin won, the Communist Party called for a no vote, which meant that about a third of the electorate voted against the constitutional changes because the Communist Party called for a no vote.
If Putin
fell and the United Russia wasn't ruling Russia, it would be the Communist Party of the Russian Federation
who would end up being president of Russia.
It
strikes me that the comment about Putin having no soul is actually designed to get him annoyed. You know, this is the sort of, it's almost like a throwback to 1154, you know, the split between the Orthodox Church and the Roman Church. Where actually a lot of this is about your faith, your beliefs, and this is a way of getting under his skin and getting him really annoyed. The idea, really, to wrong foot the guy.
Well, Putin is an ostentatious Russian Orthodox believer. He goes to church and all the rest of it. Biden, like most American politicians, is also an ostentatious believer. But as I said earlier, he doesn't really know his theology. Because the implication that Putin has got no soul is the implication that he's not human.
Yeah.
And if he's not human, he must be an alien.
I'm saying, I suppose, Martin, is that Putin will get that, and that will be a bit
I think Putin will get it, but it's like a roll of the eyes. I mean,
Look at the reasons why the West is in such a terrible state when it comes to so-called democratic elections, where you've got to pick between a whole bunch of idiots, none of whom you really want to be running the show. And that answer to that, of course, is the secret forces like the Bilderbergs, who represent many lobbies. They represent the European aristocratic lobby. They represent the oil lobby. They represent the arms lobby. They represent the banking lobby. They represent the big pharma lobby. And the question, of course, is what's happened to them? They've disappeared off the face of the earth, apparently, we're told. Henry Kissinger and his chums, Ursula von der Leyen, all these Bilderberg people, Tony Blair, David Cameron went along to one of the meetings. They are, and of course, the steering group is obviously still in contact with each other. They're still meeting. But do you think that, what do you think is going on with them? Apparently, Martin, the Bilderbergers didn't meet last year. They cancelled their meeting because of COVID-19. And now everything is kind of closed and the Bilderberg is virtually disbanded.
Well, I think the Bilderberg group is a networking group for the mid-Atlantic ruling class.
Martin, I'd say the networking group because of its attachment to NATO.
Yes, but don't forget that it's only one of the meeting places that they have. They had loads of meetings which didn't have names. They can phone each other up any time on WhatsApp.
I think you're missing the point I'm trying to get at here, which is that Bilderberg is where the politicians that then seem to take over seem to be groomed. I mean, they're invited along to these conferences, they're schmoozed. It may be that the end game is coming soon. They've got all the politicians they need, they know who they are, and they're going for broke.
Well, I would argue that they've probably got other mechanisms of doing that. The Council for Foreign Relations, for example, of which Nick Keir Starmer is a member, is not the Bilderberg Group. The Bilderberg Group is actually a fairly low-level organisation of the deep state.
Can we just clear this up? Because I think he's actually part of the Trilateral Commission, which is, you know, he's definitely down from one step down from the Bilderbergers in the sort of hierarchy of power, in that it also includes a lot of Asian countries, African countries and things like that in the Trilateral Commission. The Council on Foreign Relations is a very, you know, just United States. There is a thing called the European Council on Foreign Relations, which Nicola Sturgeon is part of, which brings me neatly on to talk about her. Do you think she's going to last the next week?
I think she probably will, because don't forget that Boris Johnson, Priti Patel, broke the ministerial code. Various people have broken the ministerial code, and he's done nothing to remove them whatsoever. And I think it's Starmer and Ruth Davison from the Tories are calling for her to go, and I think it's most unlikely that she will.
On principle, do you think she should?
Well, not really, no. I mean, all of this stuff's come out. If you look at the opinion polls in Scotland, overwhelmingly people believe her rather than Alex Salmond.
Personally, I think she should go.
That's the reality.
She's an absolutely appalling leader. She's stuck the knife straight into Alex Salmond as soon as she took over from him. And whereas I think he'd garnered a lot of support for a genuine Scottish Nationalist Party, she is basically now using that as an attempt to sort of turn Scotland. I mean, one of the first things she did, of course, was to get rid of the various police forces, to unify it one to one police force. It's an exercise in centralisation of power, as far as I can see from her point of view.
Well, we will have to see how this plays out. My suspicion is that Alex Salmond, who was basically playing outside the rules, I mean, what he said in court was, I did have sex with various people, but it was consenting, and the jury agreed with him. I think he was possibly set up by the special demonstration squad and people we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, my five.
In other words, what? Yes, he was. The jury were convinced that he was basically telling the truth, that he'd had consensual sex with various people, and therefore they acquitted him. But for him to then go on to play, I mean, and of course, Nicola Sturgeon quite possibly was in cahoots with others to try and get rid of him because of the you know, for whatever reason, because there's these, you know, the power corrupts and all the rest of it. But if you actually look at opinion polls within Scotland, she is much more liked than he is. And he's basically is very much yesterday's man.
I'd have to totally disagree.
I very much, Martin, doubt whether she's going to resign.
I have to totally disagree with your polls, I'm afraid, because certainly the Scots I speak to, maybe I'm just speaking.
Well, that's just what Scots you speak to, Tom.
You have to
look at the actual opinion polls.
Yeah, I know. Well, you don't have to necessarily look at these opinion polls when they're wrong. My sense is that Alex was much better liked by Scots generally than Nicola, and that she rankles with a lot of Scots people. But we shall see when it comes to the elections in May how well she gets on, if she's still leader at the time.
She's still there.
So let's, before we get completely away from Biden, which we have, I'm afraid, the Bilderbergers. So this is my conjecture, is that the Bilderbergers are very close to their end game of whatever it is they're up to, which could be World War III. It could be an economic collapse. It could be you know, spreading biological weapons around the place. Good God knows what on earth knows what they're up to, but they certainly want to create a massive crisis in order to take over the world. That seems to be their object, or at least increase their power around the world. I think there might be a few people, such as President Xi and President Putin, that've got something to say about that if they do give it a go. But let's have a listen now to this back to this interview, which is, by the way, Joe Biden has not done a single press conference, has he? He doesn't, because we used to get a weekly conference from Trump, and in fact, sometimes more often than weekly, where he would sit in front of the press and answer questions live. We haven't had a single one of those from Sleepy Joe. Maybe it's that, you know, you can't script those, and there's no opportunity for the whole thing to be written by autocue. Let's have a listen now anyway to this recent, this is the first big interview that Biden has done since he became president. And here he is talking about the promise to remove American troops from Afghanistan. That's after whatever it is now. Of course, it's 20 years they've been sitting in there, still trying to find bin Laden in a cave. But they haven't found him, so they've carried on the search, I suppose. So let's have a listen now to Biden talking about whether he's going to give up the search from bin Laden and come home from Afghanistan.
President Trump reached a deal with the Taliban to have all American troops leave by May 1st. Are they going to leave?
I'm in the process of making that decision now as to when they'll leave. The fact is that that was not a very solidly negotiated deal that the president, the former president, worked out. And so we're in consultation with our allies as well as the government, and that decision's going to be, it's in process now.
It's likely to take longer?
I don't think a lot longer.
But May 1st is tough.
Could happen, but it is tough because, look, one of the drawbacks, George, and this is going to be like Sanskrit to people listening here, but it is the failure to have an orderly transition from the Trump presidency to my presidency, which usually takes place from election day to the time you're sworn in, has cost me time and consequences. For example, we didn't realize how bad things were in terms of lack of vaccines. We were not able to get access to this information. That's one of the issues we're talking about now in terms of Afghanistan.
Well, he's been pretty vague there, isn't he? Not a lot longer than May the 1st. So, and also, it's just the way Biden comes across as a ridiculously slippery character with no actual commitment to anything at all, just trying to avoid really answering the question, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, did he say something about Sanskrit there, or did I mishear it?
He was saying that it was a bit too complicated to explain to the stupid public, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. He said something about Sanskrit. Anyway, yes, I mean, he's got a reputation for being, you know, one picnic short of one sandwich sort of a picnic, hasn't he? Underlying all of this, of course, is that they're not going to leave Afghanistan. I think you can be pretty certain that they aren't. Because the whole purpose of being in Afghanistan is to frustrate the Belt and Road project by the Chinese and to prevent them linking up with the Russians. So they don't really need to be in Afghanistan in terms of controlling anything other than bases. They're not going to give up those bases.
Martin, aren't they sort of into organic farming of certain red flowers as well?
Well, yes, of course. The other thing that's going on is that the drugs industry in Afghanistan is basically under the protection of the US military. Many of the planes flying by Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, which is the biggest US base in Europe, are carrying heroin back to the United States and into Europe. And Walid Karzai, who was the brother of the previous president of Afghanistan, he was working for the CIA at the same time as he was running drugs out of the country. So, yes, it's partly to do with the fact that they've got a big slush fund from the heroin trade. But it's also, if you look where Afghanistan is, it's a strategic place to try and, control Central Asia. And of course, they're not there to catch bin Laden. They claim that they caught him in the Abbottabad incident some years ago, if you remember, where, of course, nobody in Pakistan believes that he was there. Bin Laden's been dead for a very long time, probably died of kidney failure many years ago. And then, of course, they resurrect him.
Well,
like,
but you mean before the war on terror even started?
Quite possibly, yeah. I mean, there are what you might call propaganda for internal consumption in the US. And then there's what the real world and what people, you know, other intelligence services, et cetera, know what really went on. You know, so the former head of the ISI in Pakistan, General Gul, is on the record as saying, as far as I can see, 9/11, well, we know 9/11 was carried out by the US security forces. And he used to be the head of the Pakistani intelligence services, who worked with the US throughout the war in Afghanistan to drive out the Soviets. And of course, people like that are very well aware of what goes on. But of course, the ordinary population are blissfully ignorant.
Okay, so, I mean, going back to the big news of the year, which was unreported yesterday in most of the Western media, the lack of a Russian ambassador anymore in Washington for an indefinite period. What's your guess as to whether the ambassador will return? And if so, when, Martin?
Well, it may be the case that the Russians will just say, we're not sending an ambassador back. If you want to talk to us, there'll be a deputy ambassador or some lower level person there, and you can talk to them. Because, you know, you just think that you can just insult us with impunity and that we're not going to take any action. And basically, this is a very mild action. We're just going to withdraw our ambassador so that you get the message. The Nord Stream 2 pipeline is just coming to fruition. The Americans are pushing really hard for it to be cancelled. It may be cancelled. If it is, the Russians will just shrug their shoulders and say,
don't have our gas then. Martin, won't the Americans just blow it up?
Well, ultimately, in a war, you could just blow it up. Yeah. I mean, that's the problem with all of these pipelines.
Well, there may
be, of course, if you start blowing up their pipelines, your pipelines.
Accidents can happen, can't they?
Yeah. I mean, the real danger is that you might find an adventurous attitude developing in Kiev, because Biden is very much in cahoots. You know, his son was involved in corruption, as we know, in the Ukraine during the Obama era. And the far right in the Ukraine are feeling emboldened to do something. You know, they won't do anything without a US green light.
Okay. But
the fact that they're moving all these heavy weapons to the front line suggests, and they're also shelling and carrying out all kinds of sabotage operations.
I mean, I gave
they're ramping it all up. I just had the war in Azerbaijan against Armenia, which the Armenians lost, and that's given encouragement to the Ukrainians, who are developing an alliance with Turkey that they can take on the separatists in the East Ukraine.
And opinion on it, Martin, earlier, but what about your opinion on when Biden says something as a sort of flippant comment, as you'll see shortly, what price Putin will have to pay for something he didn't do, but it doesn't seem to matter to the journalists or to the president of the United States that he didn't do it. What he says you will see shortly, is that a real threat? And if so, what might happen?
Well, it's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, it may be that, this is all saber rattling. Because what's really about is the Benjamins, as they say in the United States, which is because Benjamin Franklin's on the dollar. It could be that they're just going to keep on ratcheting up the tension, the pressure, just keep shouting from the rooftops, and because they just want loads of money to be spent on an arms race. And of course, the British have now, you know, leapt in with their 40% increase in their nuclear warheads,
I wonder that maybe what will happen with these nuclear warheads is there's a whole kind of production line, isn't there, at Burfield, and I can't remember the other name of the place. There's a couple, Aldermaston, that's right, and that all of these warheads they have to be regularly replenished with tritium, so they go in for servicing again and again, the plutonium warheads. And so it might be that they've got actually quite a few sitting around that, in order to try and make sure that the the warheads that are out there on the missiles and the bombs or whatever they've got are ready. So they may just, you know, just be kind of recirculating those or getting them ready to go out more quickly. But I noticed this week that CNBC, which is a Canadian, big Canadian broadcaster, did an excellent report on what Boris was saying this week about the changes to Britain's nuclear policy. They made a big thing of it, saying that it was the nuclear weapons. Britain changes its policy so it can use nuclear weapons in response to emerging technologies, in inverted commas. So this whole idea of what emerging technologies might be.
Yes, they said doctrinal threats as well.
So Britain's 111-page integrated defence review published on Tuesday included a subtle line on when the UK reserves the right to use nuclear weapons. So this is a shift in policy, a very important one, again, virtually unreported here, a bit like the Russian ambassador leaving Washington. It says the UK could use nuclear weapons if other countries use weapons of mass destruction against it. Well, there's no great changes there necessarily, but such weapons include emerging technologies, they say, that could have a comparable impact to chemical, biological weapons or nuclear weapons. So there's a bit of an analysis in this article. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Some British newspapers report that emerging technologies include cyber attacks, citing defence insiders, but the report doesn't explicitly say that. The UK government did not immediately respond to a CNBC request for comment. Tom Plant, a director at the Royal United Services Institute think tank, told CNBC, so at least the Canadians are phoning him up and asking him what he thinks, even if the Brits aren't. I would not interpret it to include cyber attacks in isolation, comma, no, says Tom Plant at the RUSI. He added the understanding of what constitutes emerging technology in government is not evenly distributed. Cyber is not emerging necessarily. It's pretty substantially already emerged. So anyway, this is a farcical debate being had here, Rob, Martin, about, you know, what constitutes something which they are allowed, the British government are allowed to then nuke somebody for, which just seems incredible. This sort of debate can be taking place in a Canadian newspaper, but not here in the UK at all.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, it's always been NATO strategic doctrine, including British doctrine, that they won't commit to the non-first use of nuclear weapons. They've always said, we're not going to say whether we're going to use them or not. We're going to use them if we think we can. And of course, the US threatened North Vietnam and North Korea with nuclear weapons, even though they were not nuclear weapon states. So they've already done it. And it's both the Russians and the Chinese have said, we will never use nuclear weapons first. Now, in fact, making a statement like that doesn't mean anything much, because you could say that and then you could still go for a first strike if you felt it was in your interest. So in a sense, that doesn't mean much. But the West has never even said that it will only use them in response to an attack. They've always said that we reserve the right to use them when we think it's okay to use them, and we want our enemies to be on their guard and to know that we could if we wanted to, and we're not going to say we're not going to use them. And now most people in Britain have been fed the line that we've only got nuclear weapons to be used as a last resort if we are ourselves attacked. Now, that is not, in fact, what Britain says in international diplomacy. That's not the position. The position is we will use them if we think that we've got some advantage from using them.
If we fancy.
And that is actually the position. If you remember a few years ago, Jeremy Corbyn was put on the spot whether he would press the button under the circumstances that we were under attack, and he was umming and ahhing. But, of course, the real problem is the British have always said, well, if we want to use them, we're going to use them, and nobody's going to tell us what, you know, we are an imperial power. We decide whether we're going to use them or not. Nobody else can tell us.
Okay,
and we're not saying we're only going to use them as a defensive measure.
The UK's nuclear programme is Trident, established in 1980 under secret committees, which were then looked at very beautifully and wonderfully by Duncan Campbell at the BBC in his Secret Society series. In one of the programmes that was banned about secret cabinet committees, where they made sure that there was actually no real debate and discussion about whether Trident was going to be adopted or not. And now costs the UK about, it's quite cheap, really. It's only £2 billion a year to operate it.
That's cheaper than test and trace, then.
I know, and allowing a self-imposed cap on nuclear weapons stockpile to 260, abandoning the previous cap of 225. The current reduction target of 180 by the mid-2020s, well, that's obviously completely out the window now. They're not going to be reducing them at all. But Martin, do you think really is the only nuclear weapons that Britain has got, or we maybe got some others squirreled away secretly, like battlefield weapons, etc.?
I doubt it. I mean, if you think about it, even if we're talking about
tactical nuclear weapons, really, aren't we here?
Yeah, well, another thing that people haven't picked up on is that basically the US has withdrawn from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which basically was about tactical nuclear weapons which could be used in Europe, and it was the major achievement of the Gorbachev-Reagan era to agree that we'd just get rid of those because they're just a tripwire that could lead to a conflagration, and they don't have any useful purpose. But of course, that's been got rid of now.
One of the things I'd say is, you know, this does suggest to me a lot of this that, you know, we're so far down the line of secrecy when it comes to all this stuff that there almost certainly is some sort of other nuclear program or several other nuclear programs around that nobody's told about. The other part of this defense review, the Integrated Defence Review, also outlined this new tilt towards the Indo-Pacific region. It doesn't specifically mention China. Are we turning on our old Indian colonial friends?
Well, what's happened, of course, is in the 1960s, the Labour government withdrew all British forces from east of Suez. And that was the last time that British forces were driven out of Aden, which is now Yemen, at that time. And we've still got, we've agreed to build, and we've built, a base in Bahrain, which, of course, the locals do not want at all. The Al Khalifa family that rule Bahrain were put in power by the British. They've been in power for years.
That's hardly the Indo-Pacific region, is it?
Sorry?
That's not the Indo-Pacific region at all.
No, yeah, but we're moving in that direction. Our aircraft carrier, the Queen Elizabeth, is steaming towards the South China Sea as we speak. Of course, if it came to a fight in the South China Sea, it would be sunk almost immediately.
So it's the Royal Navy just being used.
The Chinese shore batteries will just knock it out straight away.
So the Royal Navy just being used as cannon fodder for the Americans?
Well, yeah, I mean, what they're doing there with these so-called freedom of navigation operations is what the Irish used to call coat trailing, where you just trail your coat, and if somebody stands on your coat, then you can punch him, and you can create a confrontation.
So,
all of this is incredibly dangerous.
Well,
it's
how
probably
close
more
is
dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis?
You
have to search the magnifying glass to find discussions of this in mainstream media.
So how close is the Queen Elizabeth, this aircraft carrier, allowed to go to Beijing and the coast of China before the Chinese take it out?
Well, that is a debatable point, isn't it? Because if the Chinese, from the strategic point of view, the Chinese are surrounded by enemies, effectively, and the sea, as you go out of China, you've got the first island chain and the second island chain. And what the Americans and their allies, including us, are doing is trying to force the Chinese forces back behind the second island chain, you know, the closer island chain, the first island chain, and then to dominate the sea routes into and out of China. Now, if the Chinese were trying to do that to the Americans, they'd go absolutely nuts. And you can imagine what we might do if a Chinese aircraft carrier turned up in the North Atlantic, for example. Never mind steaming down the channel, as that Russian aircraft carrier did some years ago. It's very provocative, and ultimately, of course, the Chinese are preparing to deal with the situation from their point of view, and comes to a fight, they're going to sink them all.
Yeah, but they don't have to
Taiwan to boot just to get, you know,
The Chinese could quite simply get a whole load of horrendously massive chains, a little mini sub, and then they could stick the chains over the propellers of our massive aircraft carrier, And then when it's stopped and ground to a halt and started drifting, they can simply say, oh, you seem to be having some problem. Would you like a tow? And they can be nice to us. And, you know, the idea that an aircraft carrier is going to be doing any kind of use over there threatening China just seems to be completely kowtowing to what the Yanks want.
It is. And, of course, from a strategic point of view, military point of view, it's purposeless. I mean, you know, the Chinese silkworm missiles, which are based on basically coastal defences, they can take them out. An aircraft carrier is a massive target. You know, it's basically old technology from the Second World War. They won't survive 5 minutes. The same thing would happen in any attack on Iran. The only way to use aircraft carriers is to have them way out in the middle of the ocean, in the middle of the Pacific, beyond the range of Chinese missiles. The same with Iran. If you've got the aircraft carriers going into the Persian Gulf, they are absolutely sitting targets. The only way to use them would be to have them out in the Indian Ocean and then flying stuff in from there, which, of course, is feasible. But, of course, if you do move your aircraft carrier into the middle of the Indian Ocean, then that's when the Iranians know that you're about to attack them and they've got plenty of things that they can shoot at anyway. So, I mean, the whole thing is absolutely crazy. And meanwhile, of course, there's about to be an election in Israel where both parties that may win, Gantz or Netanyahu, are promising the electorate we're going to have a war with Iran. Meanwhile, of course, back in Blighty, we've got Priti Patel worrying about people trespassing.
They're obviously trying to stop the people that would lead a kind of mass movement demonstration against such an insane war. That's what they're doing, is they're turning on the domestic population and making sure there's no democracy at home. Anyway, before we get off the military stuff, the census, which many people have been filling out, and some people have been picking it up and leaving it on the shelf and wondering whether they should fill it out or not. You remember last time, Martin, it was Lockheed Martin who were doing it. This time, of course, it's just a subsidiary or a business colleague, friend of Lockheed Martin, a company called Leidos. Leidos is listed by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, bless them, as the 19th biggest arms and military services company in the world in 2019, with arms sales of $5.3 billion out of total sales of just about double that. Here in the UK, Leidos does a lot of work for the Ministry of Defence. The British military paid them $276 million for various services in 2016 to 2017, as another glorious, wonderful organisation called the Campaign Against the Arms Trade has pointed out. Leidos mainly does military IT and support services, though it did buy a military hardware company called Dianetics for $1.65 billion in 2020. So isn't that wonderful? Hand all your information over to a military company. Once again, if you want to do the census, I mean, this is something that really the government should be doing, Martin, but this is indicative of a complete and utter change over the last 30 years or so, or maybe 40 since the Thatcher era, of privatisation of everything that government do. And now it's the military, private military, come to that, arms company, that's deciding, compiling lists of everybody. Now, obviously, that's very useful for anyone that wanted to, like the Nazis did, profile their population.
It is. And, you know, I find that absolutely incredible. If the census is going to be a non-political thing where we, assess the population so that we can plan things like how many schools do we need, how many hospital beds, etc., which is a perfectly legitimate thing, then it should be done by the government. And it should be, you know, completely secure. Why should anybody make a profit out of doing that? And, of course, this is the way the West is going. Is that we've got a growing state. The state gets bigger and bigger all the time, but the point is it's a privatised state where profits can be made by private individuals who are closely connected to government and corporations. And, you know, you could imagine that you know, lots of people are going to say, well, we're not going to fulfil. I mean, in Northern Ireland back in the day, they couldn't really collect the census in Republican areas because people were basically being shot who went round to ask questions. And, you know, that could happen again. If the level of trust goes down, as it seems to be, the government will have to fly blind because lots of people won't cooperate with them.
Apparently, it's a decade after, I said final, sorry, it's not, after the death of Gaddafi, a bloodbath following the NATO strikes in Libya. 10 years after the Libyan revolution, victims are waiting for justice. It's just been a bloodbath there, Martin, hasn't it? And in fact, I can remember all these people saying Gaddafi has to go. Well, they've got egg on their face, rather.
Yes, well, there was even a House of Commons select committee that concluded that the casus belli, the excuse for war, was fraudulent. They claimed that they had to put in a no-fly zone because Gaddafi had threatened to kill the population of Benghazi like rats. And what Gaddafi had actually said is the people who have got taking up arms against us, we're going to deal with them like rats, but everybody else should, don't worry, we're not going to. And in any case, they would never have, what use would air power have been against essentially, you know, rebels who were embedded within the population with small arms? And there was no, and the Russians said at the time, we've got satellites. There was never any air power being used by the Libyan military. That, you know, it would have been, it wouldn't have served any useful purpose. And of course, they then put in a no-fly zone in which both China and Russia abstained in the Security Council because they thought that what the West was trying to do was force some kind of negotiation between Gaddafi and his opposition, which might lead to some kind of transition, peaceful transition of power in Libya. But as soon as that was in place, the RAF carried out bombing missions and of course the French and the Americans eventually had to come in because the British and the French couldn't do it on their own. And Gaddafi was bombed out of power, and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group were working with our special forces to do all of this. And then, of course, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group then blew up Manchester and killed a load of innocent people. But, of course, they'd been working with MI6 and the British SAS for years and years and years, going back to the 1980s when lots of Libyans were recruited to fight in Afghanistan against the Soviets, and then they were given a base in Britain in Manchester. That's the reality of history. And, of course, the Italians weren't very happy about the overthrow of Gaddafi because they said this is going to lead to chaos and loads of people are just going to end up flooding into Italy, which is exactly what has happened. And, of course, the right wing in Italy are saying, well, we didn't start this war. It was the British and the French, so you can take all the refugees. We don't want them.
The Secretary of State, Secretary of Defence, Lloyd Austin. Well, he's an interesting guy. Basically just a general from the army who was a four-star general. He's now Secretary of Defense. He has been warning North Korea, Martin. He's saying the US is ready to fight tonight.
Well, this is the US, presumably, rather than the British general. Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems to me that they're going for maximum confrontation on all fronts. And any hopes that more moderate forces in Russia, China and Iran might have had that the Biden administration was going to be more reasonable than the previous setup, they didn't hold much hope out, but now they've got no hope. And ultimately, of course, this is crazy. People read Paul Craig Roberts, who used to be Reagan's economics advisor, but he's become quite sensible in his old age. And he's saying there's a real danger here that we're just going to trip over into a nuclear war. That's how dangerous this is. It's probably more dangerous in many respects than the Cuban Missile Crisis, because in the Cuban Missile Crisis, you actually had rational leaders on both sides who stared into the abyss and walked away from it. We've got people here, especially in the West, who are quite capable of just starting a nuclear war by accident because of the political rhetoric which they feel empowered to just use as if words didn't have consequences.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, how this is all sort of starting to ramp up with the no ambassador business with the Russians and taking their ambassador out of Washington. I mean, this is shocking stuff, really. And what with the pandemic in the background still supposedly chugging along, and certainly lots of restrictions on people's movements, on assembly and all this sort of thing that we saw the police weighing in last Saturday night, much to the disgust of most of the British people, to see them weighing in like a bunch of thugs into a vigil for somebody who is alleged to have been murdered by a police officer really beggars belief. But let's have a listen now to the latest from Steve Hilton. He's pretty much unmissable, really. And I mean, I'm not a massive fan of Fox News, right? But this is great to see at least one mainstream media service around the world doing some real research and some real work on what looked to me to be the most likely origins of the COVID-19 virus being released over in Wuhan. But the question, of course, is where was it made? And we'll be looking at that in a minute. But here is Steve Hilton from last Sunday evening on the Lex Revolution's latest, where he talks about the lockdowns and the effects that they've had.
So this week, it was a year since the official start of the pandemic, and there was a phrase you heard over and over again in the media, the devastation that it inflicted.
A year of devastation from the pandemic.
The pandemic's devastating toll.
Working class and poor families who were devastated by this pandemic.
Except the devastation wasn't inflicted by the pandemic. It was inflicted by the government, starting with the CDC, which catastrophically bungled testing. So it was impossible to contain the virus here in the way that places like South Korea and Hong Kong did. Never forget how the media's precious CDC failed us. About a month after Germany developed their tests, the CDC finally built ours, except it didn't work and had to be recalled. Precious weeks went by. University labs and the private sector were begging to make a test. The FDA said no. Finally, at the end of February, only after President Trump intervened, the red tape was swept away. At that vital moment when it might still have been possible to contain America's outbreak, the CDC's arrogance and incompetence were fatal. Having allowed the virus to spread uncontrolled for months, they then moved to their next disastrous blunder. Instead of designing a strategy for the specific characteristics of this virus, clearly known by as early as last January, that the virus was highly contagious, had a high level of asymptomatic spread, and overwhelmingly caused a problem for the elderly, our public health bureaucrats, starting in California with Santa Clara County's Sarah Cody, dusted down a playbook developed in the wake of 9/11 for a bioterrorism attack affecting everyone equally. They pushed government to seize unprecedented emergency powers, to lock everyone down, not just a small proportion at serious risk. Businesses closed, schools closed, churches closed. They told us when we could leave our homes, play sports, go to the park, go to our own family members besides bedsides in hospital. They're funerals. And here we are. Not 15 days to flatten the curve later, but a year later. They're still inflicting their lockdowns on us. Tens of millions of jobs lost, hundreds of thousands of businesses closed, lives and dreams destroyed thanks to their lockdowns. Families torn apart by mental illness, suicide, drug abuse, domestic violence, child abuse, thanks to their lockdowns. It didn't even work on its own terms. We laid out an alternative. Protect the vulnerable. Focus testing and PPE on the elderly. Keep them safe, but allow healthy Americans to live normally. We were attacked for putting lives at risk. But guess who now admits we were right? Unbelievably, the wretched CDC. Look at the guidance they published this week. They say vaccinated people should continue to wear masks and social distance in public places, presumably because they think that even vaccinated people could still spread the virus. But despite this, they say that vaccinated people can see unvaccinated people with no masks and no social distancing if they are at low risk. That is most people. So by the CDC's own admission, anyone could have gotten close to anyone else at low risk for the past year. Instead, we had a year of utter madness, unscientific, in direct contradiction of the data. The CDC, Fauci and the idiots in the media recklessly pushing misinformation that terrified Americans into thinking that getting infected was a guaranteed death sentence. They condemned Trump when his disruptive business-like action gave us the single thing that will actually end the pandemic, the historic vaccine achievements of Operation Warp Speed. And they fawn over Biden when all the good news he touts is actually thanks to Trump and Biden's own response, judging from that address to the nation the other night, is a rambling, incoherent mess. No surprise there if he's listening to Fauci, who says maybe it's summer before we get back to normal, maybe Christmas, maybe next year. More likely never. They love the power. They love the control over our lives. They love being the center of attention. No, we must not let them turn this into a permanent pandemic and never-ending lockdown. We need a clear endpoint. Declare VV Day, victory over the virus. And that should be when every American over the age of 65 has had the chance to be vaccinated. At that point, all restrictions must end. So as we mourn the dead and pick up the pieces of a devastating year, let's be clear. All this pain and suffering was not caused by a natural disaster like a hurricane or an earthquake. The cruel, counterproductive lockdown strategy, and maybe even the pandemic itself, as we'll see in a moment, was a man-made disaster, or more precisely, a government-made disaster, and more precisely still, a disaster made by the very people in our government who were supposed to protect us, the people running our public health bureaucracies. After millions dead, economic devastation, social destruction, we need honesty and accountability, not to point fingers or to cast blame, but to make sure this never happens again. Follow us at Steve Hilton X and at NextRev FNC and share this message when we post it.
Well, I mean, I certainly don't agree with a lot of that. I agree with a lot of the things he's saying there. I found it a good rant, basically, a good tabloidy rant. But, you know, he's not really mentioning anything there about the infiltration and the domination of these public health bodies, like here in Britain, the MHRA, by Big Pharma, by the massive pharmaceutical companies. The idea of blaming it on the government is what he's trying to do there. And he's putting out Trump as the great hero in it. But he's making a lot of good points, but he seems to be missing the main point, which is that what we're dealing with is a man-made virus, which the response to which has been managed almost totally by private interests who are going to make as much money as they can, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been listening to him with interest to what he's been doing in the previous weeks, which was actually investigative journalism about the source of the virus. That is basically a lot of bombast by him there. And I understand you've got another clip with him talking about the causes of the virus in a minute. But, I mean, to my mind, we've just been talking about world wars and all the rest of it. I think that the Wuhan laboratory was infiltrated by the US deep state, that they, in fact, developed the biological weapon, which is what it is. They released it inside China deliberately in order to try and mess up the Chinese economy as part of World War III. It misfired because the Chinese, they did have a lockdown in Wuhan. They didn't have a lockdown of the whole country. And, of course, the lockdown measures that have been adopted in the West since the virus was allowed to spread are indeed designed to control the population, etc., etc. But of course, some countries had locked down early in Southeast Asia, and they are back to work now. There is no lockdown in China. There's no lockdown in Taiwan. Well, I mean, there's no lockdown in Vietnam.
People might well argue, Martin, that there's no need for the lockdowns in the West. But look,
if it's a biological warfare attack, Tony,
yeah, Martin,
which is what Tony is arguing, the other Tony is
Martin,
arguing.
No, you like always have the last word. You've just had a lot to say there. That's my last word, is that there are people, many people, including the former chief scientific officer of Pfizer, is saying there is no need to have the lockdown now. And as actually Steve Hilton was there saying, one of the best tactics you can adopt is to protect the vulnerable and allow people who are not likely to catch it in any bad way to catch it, a bit like chickenpox or whatever. Anyway, the other aspect to all this I'd like to look at is a story which is like almost forgotten, which is about the Harvard scientist on the 28th of January 2020 last year, Martin, when we were still on the air and reporting at that week, I believe, the fascinating research being done in India, which was looking at the genome published by the Chinese, saying, well, hang on a minute, this looks like a man-made virus. It wasn't even called COVID-19 at that point. It was still SARS-CoV-2. Anyway, on the 28th of January, a Harvard scientist was charged with lying about his ties to Chinese university. The two Chinese nationals were also accused of economic espionage. The chairman of Harvard's Department of Chemistry and Chemical Biology was arrested and charged with lying about his links to the Chinese university, the latest case to surface in the US government's crackdown on suspected espionage and scientific theft. The federal authorities said Charles Lieber, L-I-E-B-E-R, a prominent nanoscientist and prolific inventor and entrepreneur, received hundreds of thousands of dollars from China. He shuffled into a Boston federal courtroom in shackles on Tuesday to face charges that stunned the area's scientific community. This is the chairman of Harvard's Department of Chemistry and Chemical Biology, Martin.
Yeah, well, what's going on here is there's been all sorts of interactions between China and the US over the years, academic and otherwise, and now they're turning on people like him and saying, ah, yes, but you're linked to the Chinese military, you're basically a spy, what are you doing here? Even though they knew what they were doing there all along. Now, it looks to me...
It may be that some parts of the government did know and other parts didn't know.
Well, obviously, that's going to be the case, however you look at it. I mean, every post office worker isn't going to know what the deep state's up to, are they? I think that the virus was developed at Fort Detrick. It either leaked accidentally from Fort Detrick, because one of the things that a Taiwanese scientist has pointed out, that every variant of the virus shows up in the United States, but only one variant shows up in China, the Wuhan variant. Now, that implies that the United States is the source of the virus. And, of course, the other thing is that the Wuhan laboratory itself was carrying out gain-of-function research funded by DARPA, which is the Pentagon's research arm, which is ARPA, is what Cummings wants Britain to have. Now, I think what the Chinese have realised is that they in good faith, allowed a cooperation with the Wuhan laboratory to develop, you know, they shouldn't be carrying out gain-of-function research. It was banned in the US by Obama because it was too dangerous. And the Chinese, for some stupid reason, allowed it to carry on territory.
Martin, yeah, but you're getting away from the point here about this Harvard professor. I mean, haven't the Chinese infiltrated this university?
Yes, of course.
They're paying this guy to cook up various biological wonders and then stick them in a case and bring them over to China for them. And this was going on and on and on. It's just that at this point, at the end of January, someone's saying, well, hang on, there's a nasty virus about to break out called SARS-CoV-2. Perhaps we should pounce on this bloke and wonder what he's up to. So you could be right, you know, that there may be various links going on which the government has said, well, we would like to have, and the military has said, we would like to have private contractors like Peter Daszak developing biological weapons on the sly. And then as soon as it looks like there might be a bigger international outbreak of SARS-CoV-2, then they arrest these people, I suppose, to cover their tracks.
Yes. I mean, I've no doubt that the Chinese have carried out espionage against the US, industrial espionage and all sorts of other espionage. But suddenly discovering these people, I mean, if he's been given thousands and thousands of dollars of support by the Chinese over many, many years, they must have known about that. Why has he suddenly been arrested now? Because the line that's being taken by your Fox News journalist earlier is to come up and say, in actual fact, it's the Chinese who started all of this. They're to blame. The lockdown's
the fault of
the Chinese.
No, he's not. That's not his line at all, Martin. You got completely smart about face. His line is that this research was funded from the US, by the US, through Fauci, etc. And yeah. Peter Daszak was actually directly contracted by the Pentagon in order to do this research on the sly over in Wuhan.
Yes, but what he seems to be suggesting is this is a kind of incompetent power play by Fauci and the medical establishment.
Yeah, I mean, let's give him the credit where it's due. One of the things he's absolutely clear is he's not about apportioning blame. It's about learning what happens in order to make sure it doesn't happen again. And that's what journalists need to do. It's what the politicians should be doing. It's what everyone involved in this should be doing, but nobody seems to be.
Yes, but you've also got to ask yourself bigger questions. But it may be that it's quite deliberate, like 9/11 was deliberate. All of the evidence is there. We've got scientific papers on nanothermite and on the collapse of buildings. That was carried out not by the Chinese, but by the US deep state in order to stop.
Well, hang on a minute. What about Israel?
And Israel probably as well. Now, that puts it in a context where the deep state in the US is quite capable of developing through gain of function research a biological weapon designed to wreck the Chinese economy, which they allow to flow back over their own economy because they wanted to bail out the banks. And in November last year, the Israeli Defense Forces were given a heads up by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States of America that a pandemic was going to come out of China. How did they know? They knew because they created it. They carried out 9/11. They created COVID-19. They are behind all of this, the US deep state, and the enemies of the US deep state are the Chinese Communist Party and the Russians. And that's what World War III is going to be all about.
Okay, and the Chinese are not doing anything. They're just sitting there twiddling their thumbs.
No, the Chinese are doing something. What they did is, through administrative measures, they control the situation within their own country very rapidly. And what they're doing now is they're going all over the world and giving people free vaccines. Meanwhile, in order to win friends and influence people. Meanwhile, of course, the West is simply the Western disaster capitalists are just trying to make money out of the mess they've caused.
Well, they're
not winning
friends and influencing people in Xinjiang, putting 2 million in concentration camps, are they?
Well, we're not winning many friends in Yemen either, where the RAF are involved in murdering their children. Perhaps we need a few more car bombs around here. Perhaps Priti Patel is the only language she understands.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily going to help things, but I can see what your point. I mean, if Britain is involved in these foreign wars, there's a fascinating thing that came up. I think it's quite what the website is, I'm not sure, but it's a great bit of analysis on land grabbing going on in Africa. This, I suppose, goes back to what we were hearing from RAT and the Right to Reside groups and various others campaigning for travellers' rights, how the present-day land-grabbing in Africa is forcing thousands to migrate to Europe. Now, this is something we don't hear much about. We heard quite a bit about it over the last 20 years in places like the rainforest in South America, etc., where there's private individuals, Martin, just grabbing vast areas of land that have never really necessarily had a specific owner, but have been tribal areas for generations, well, since time immemorial. And now those bits of lands are being privatised and people are finding that they can't make a living and are heading for Europe.
Yeah, well, I mean, all sorts of pressures are being created on the rural population in the developing world. I was doing a PhD thesis, which I didn't complete, about which was related to this topic many years ago. And even in the 1960s, there was a spokesperson, a US senator, whose name now escapes me, who said, we must use subsidy of our agriculture to deter anybody else from having a viable agricultural system. And as Kissinger famously said, you know, if you can control the food supply, you can control the world's population. So this is very well advanced now. They're basically trying to drive traditional farmers off the land in Africa and elsewhere so that they become a proletariat that can be exploited in factories and so on, although they haven't actually built any factories for them either. They're just expected to die, and the land itself will be used. It's not just that they want to exploit the land and they want to have agribusiness and so on. They actually actively want to destroy traditional farmers. That's the goal, and it has been for a long time.
Then there's another article, Martin. Finally, it's called More Suggestions for Dealing with Israel from Philip Giraldi on the UN's review site. Recusal and banning dual nationality are good places to start, he says. Obviously, dual nationality, it's all based around that. And the fundamental idea here is that you've got senior people in the US government who are dual Israeli-US citizens. If anything happens that it looks like they might get prosecuted or found out that they're up to no good over in the US, that all they do is they simply hop on a plane and they're no longer a US citizen anymore. The other concept here is that they have a very good intelligence network where if any investigator or prosecutor is coming anywhere near them, they will get a warning. And so they will never get prosecuted because they always get a warning, a little text on their phone or whatever saying, hey, the feds are onto you, man.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've been embedded within the US deep state structure for years. I mean, Giraldi is suggesting something that's perfectly straightforward, which is that you should say to people, you're either a US citizen or an Israeli citizen. You can't be both. Now, that isn't going to happen. It just isn't going to happen because the politics of the US are bought and sold by the Zionist lobby, much of which is funded by US taxpayers, of course. The state of Israel is essentially a welfare state funded by US taxes. But then, of course, the resources that they then develop are then used to buy the political process inside the US. And, you know, people can be both US and Israeli citizens. And, of course, Israeli citizens can be anybody of Jewish origin anywhere in the world has a right to emigrate to Israel. Meanwhile, Palestinian families who lived there for generations are still stateless in places like Syria and Lebanon, and they have no
you say anybody, but they are supposed to be Jewish, although I've heard anecdotally from various people who say, well, certain people turned up in Israel saying they were Jewish, but they weren't at all, they just said they were.
Yeah, well, a lot of Russian mafia people found that they had Jewish ancestry, which allowed them to have both Russian and Israeli citizenship, which was very useful in terms of getting away from the law enforcement in Russia. And there's a very substantial proportion of the current Israeli population are in fact Russian speaking. And it's estimated that the Russian mafia have a very big control over the economy in Israel itself. But of course, it's this question of who's allowed to be a citizen of where is a very big one, isn't it? Palestinians can't go back to what is now Israel because they're not allowed. You know, that's been ruled out by both the Israelis and the Americans. And therefore, they are stateless in these refugee camps where they've been since the 1940s. Perhaps they should be allowed to come to Britain since we created the State of Israel, and they can join with the Hong Kong Chinese as British citizens as long as they pay their taxes and participate in the society.
Okay, well, we're going to go back to World War II now as we start to close the programme. We'll be hearing before the end from Ian R. Crane and Alan Watt. But first of all, John Harris has more on the bizarre mystery of the flight of Hitler's deputy Führer, Rudolf Hess, in May 1941 to Scotland, popping into a Messerschmitt ME-110, one of the fastest aircraft in the world at the time, and zipping across the North Sea, up the coast, 100 and whatever miles off the coast, and then across to Scotland. But we're going to hear now somebody who it looks very, very likely, and every time we get a bit more evidence, it's more likely, someone who was actually waiting for him, a member of the royal family, to meet him. But, he lost his way. It was too dark. He was a little bit late, and he couldn't find his way. So he had problems with navigation, old Hess, and so he had to bail out. And that was put an end to him meeting up with the royal family. Before we hear from John, Martin, there are suggestions that there was a potential coup going to happen with Hess negotiating directly with a faction who would have liked to join with Nazi Germany in order to have a massive war with Russia. Is that feasible?
It's certainly feasible. Not so much that we would join in a war with them, but by agreeing to a deal with Hitler, Hitler would then be given a free hand to invade the Soviet Union, which would suit the interests in Britain, which wanted that to occur. And I don't think there's much doubt that there was a fairly substantial faction within the ruling class in Britain at the time who were definitely open to that idea. So it's not at all crazy. It's quite feasible, isn't it?
Yeah, fascinating anyway. So anyway, he didn't manage to meet Prince George at this RAF air base. Instead, he was he met the Duke of Hamilton. He was on the Duke of Hamilton's estate and he was handed over. I think he was locked up in a Boy Scout hut or something, and eventually ended up being taken as one of the last ever prisoners in the Tower of London. But Rudolf Hess went from being Deputy Führer to prisoner in Scotland. But this is John Harris, and one of his latest books is about to come out, talking about what he's found out about who he was really there up in Scotland to meet.
There was a very good book published in 2003 called Double Standards, and that made the case that Prince George, the Duke of Kent, was at the airstrip. They thought it was a different air base, waiting to meet Rudolf Hess prior to taking him to London to meet his brother, who would then prorogue Parliament, which he was quite able to do constitutionally, and then force a negotiated peace in that manner. Now, that sounds very far-fetched.
So you mean the King, George VI?
The King, George VI, that's correct. So what the book was mooting was basically a constitutional coup d'etat, except for the inconvenient truth that the King and the Queen today is actually acting quite within his or her powers to prorogue Parliament. If you remember in the Brexit debate, we very nearly had, some people were muting that the Queen would actually prorogue Parliament to resolve Brexit herself. Don't know if you can remember that. That was 2 or 3 years ago. And that is what's called a reserved power. George VI certainly had that reserved power. So he could, if he wanted to, prorogue Parliament, replace the Prime Minister with somebody who would then have made a compromise peace with Germany. Constitutionally, that was quite possible. But it failed, or it didn't happen, because Hess crashed his plane and fell into government hands. So that was the premise of the book. And the problem being, we cannot find out where the Duke of Kent was on that night. I've written to the Duke, and he doesn't answer my letters. The current Duke, that is. He doesn't answer my letters. We've made freedom of information requests, but I doubt that will work because royal documents are outside the scope of the Freedom of Information Act. And so consequently, I can't tell you tonight where the Duke of Kent was. What I can tell you is on the 8th of May 1941, he was in Peterhead and Fraserburgh, which is Aberdeenshire. And I can also tell you on the 12th of May 1941, the Monday, he was at RAF Wick, right at the top of Scotland. But that weekend, from the 9th to the 11th of May, his whereabouts are currently unknown. And what doesn't help researchers like myself is that there was a story that he'd had a road traffic accident on the Sunday morning just outside of Glasgow. But I don't know if you remember the furore of the inserted document scandal at the National Records. Well, that report was part of the document insertion scandal, where an historian had fabricated what was purporting to be contemporaneous pieces of paper and had actually inserted them into the then current files. And unfortunately, the road traffic accident document was one of those that was subsequently proven to be falsified.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it was William Stevenson, the man called Intrepid, that said, "Nothing deceives like a document." So that's John Harris, and I put a longer interview with John up on YouTube, interviewed him yesterday, and also on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
We believe he was going to land at a small airstrip called RAF Dundonald, just near to Ayr.
Apparently his destination, Martin, Prince George sitting there waiting, smoking his cigarettes for Rudolf Hess.
Well, I obviously all of these things have to be researched, but it's not at all unlikely that something like that happened. And of course, as you know, John Ainsworth Davis was infiltrated into the German secret services because he claimed that he was, one of these English upper class types who was actually friendly to Hitler. And of course, the German secret services became very open to this idea. Eddie Chapman, who was the bank robber, convinced them that he was another rotter who was going to be, that in actual fact, there were whole lots of people inside the establishment in Britain who were pro-German. And the Germans convinced themselves that that was the case. And the MI6 used that to infiltrate people into the German structure. So to such an extent that Eddie Chapman, who was based in Norway, was actually given an Iron Cross by Hitler, even though he was working for the British the whole time. But of course, as we know, Morton in the end did a deal with Bormann, and the Nazi infrastructure in Germany, the real Nazi infrastructure, was ultimately protected by and basically incorporated into NATO. So all of this is more grist to the mill. This is the reality of how things actually were, rather than all the mythology that people learn in school, I'm afraid.
I mean, is it really possible that history could have hinged on whether that meeting with Rudolf Hess took place or not? I mean, one does wonder whether Hess was really necessary in that situation. They could have had their coup with or without him, surely.
They could. They could indeed. And I think what happened at that stage, if you think about what Morton and the others, people like him, were doing at that stage, is they were encouraging the Germans in the belief that they could, in fact, get the British on side. And that basically encouraged the Germans to carry on thinking that they might be able to, basically that allowed them to infiltrate people into their structure who pretended to be from that faction in order to compromise the situation. And of course, officially, that was a way in which the British intelligence services foxed the Germans. But of course, ultimately, they were prepared to deal with the right
people. Also, of course, General Sikorsky was. General Sikorsky was also involved in a rather nasty crash, as was Prince George about a year after this Hess incident. I've had a bit of a look into the crash of Prince George's Sunderland. That would have been it's one of the Queen's uncles. He crashed, and although it looks as if there may have been, certainly the aircraft was off course. Prince George was almost certainly flying the aircraft, and he'd taken over the controls, saying, he's the senior officer, and the pilot had to get out of the way, and he took over, and he decided to change course. The only trouble was the Sunderland is a lumbering old beast, and it wasn't very good at climbing or turning, and he was going down these valleys into the mountains, where he had very little option but to try and follow the river, making very sharp turns, because he couldn't gain height in a Sunderland. And eventually you can see the place where they crashed is where they were obviously trying to turn the corner, but the Sunderland couldn't make it round. The other thing about that crash was that there was an extra person on board, because they counted all the people who were found at the scene, and there was the right number. The thing they didn't know was that the rear gunner, Andy Jack, had staggered away and was in a nearby hamlet recuperating. And so they weren't looking for anybody else, but there was someone extra on the aircraft. And Andy Jack's niece, who lives in Prestatyn, has said that he told her that this was Prince George's boyfriend who was on the aircraft, an extra person. And of course, had that been known at the time, there would have been a massive scandal about it.
Yeah, but that tends to suggest that the scandal is about Prince George's boyfriend rather than anything of more significance politically.
Yeah,
I don't know what happened there, but that would tend to suggest that that's what's going on there rather than anything else. Although, of course,
I totally agree. It's just it seems like a very unhappy situation where a senior officer who's drunk, potentially, apparently he was drunk, has taken over the controls of an aircraft and killed everyone else on board in rather a stupid fashion. But anyway, an unnecessary fashion. But anyway, let's go on to our final item, which is looking at the lives of Ian Crane and Alan Watt, two big campaigners for the truth about 9/11. And the sort of people that the mainstream media have tried to snuff out by making sure they don't get heard, but both of them fighting in their own way to make sure they do. And of course, they've got fascinating things to say, both of them. And I thought we'd start tonight with Ian R. Crane, because he was our chair, Martin, wasn't he, at the 9/11 Truth Movement back in the mid-noughties?
Well, I don't think there was anything as, the structure was more flexible than that, but he was definitely a prominent organizer of events.
He was convening the meetings and then chairing the meetings.
He definitely played a big role.
Back in the mid-noughties, there was a formal chair. We had Andy Thomas 1 year. Various people were chairing the group. But anyway, let's have a listen now to this is AV9, one of the last conferences that Ian organised, because that was his thing. He organised these alternative view conferences. Here he is talking about, well, you can make up your own mind about it, but the title of his talk is Democracy in Chains. And he's talking here about the crucial role of Middle England.
What we are looking at is, you know, we are on the cusp, and we've been on the cusp for some time, but we're on the cusp of something very significant. And which way this goes is absolutely going to be down to what I'm going to refer to as Middle England. Middle England. You know, whether we like to admit it or not, the reality is that no social change at any time in history has ever occurred until the middle classes actually start to realize that unless they get involved, then their hard worked for gains are at risk of being taken away. And it doesn't matter where you go in history, over the last 6,000 years, it's only when the middle classes actually start to take an interest. You know, the working classes are ready for change anytime, because there's a significant chunk of them that are downtrodden, kept in poverty. But I'm not going to get into the whys and the wherefores, but unfortunately, even if they do rise, just ask Wat Tyler, you know, even if they do rise, it never has the legs, because they don't have the support of Middle England. And if you haven't got the support of Middle England, then what Middle England does when they rise is just go, oh, I don't want to go there. And an illustration of that is what happened in 1979, which is very, very significant, because that's the turning point that started to get us into this mess. How many people here remember the winter of discontent? Yeah. I got to say that I had absolute disdain for the trade unions in that point, in that period, because they had completely lost Middle England. You know, whatever their motivation, but they had lost Middle England. And I believe that they were deliberately set up to bring about what was needed to get the corporatocracy back in full control. And they fell for it hook, line, and sinker. And so did I. Because as I've made the admission a number of times, I couldn't wait to vote for Margaret Thatcher back in 1979. If only I knew then. But hey, you know, I was 22, I think, at the time. And, you know, I was seeing what was occurring around the country, and I was experiencing firsthand, you know, some active trade unionism, which in my opinion was not in the best interests of their membership. And for me, at the time, the trade union movement needed a slap. Unfortunately, it got a lot more than that. And of course, then the coup de grace was the brilliant strategy of Arthur Scargill. And taking the miners out on strike in March, when the stockpiles of coal around the country were the highest they had ever been. Now, at the time, I was living in East Anglia, and there was a coal-fired power station on the banks of the River Orwell, just on the edge of Ipswich. And the Orwell Bridge, which was fairly recently opened at that point, the Orwell Bridge rose quite steeply over the River Orwell, because it was ocean-going vessels that came up to Ipswich at that time. And the stockpile of coal was so enormous, it came way above the bridge. And I could see, you know, it didn't take a rocket scientist to work out what was occurring then. And by then I was, 27? So, you know, I was starting to get a better feel for the bigger picture at that time. So I knew that the intention here was to use the miners' strike, one, to destroy the coal mining industry in this country, because obviously North Sea oil was now effectively the main source of energy, so we no longer needed 282,000 members of the NUM, and we certainly didn't need their graft in the mines, so the rug was pulled from under them. And Arthur Scargill, wittingly or otherwise, facilitated that opportunity. And so the corporatocracy by the mid-80s was well and truly embedded. And of course, Hollywood serves its role, because anyone remember the key film that was released at that time to push this agenda? Star Wars. It was called Wall Street. Wall Street. And of course, the mantra of Wall Street was greed is good. Greed is good. And then we had Harry Enfield offering the comic version of that with loads of money. And, you know, we think, oh, that's comedy. But this is all part of the influence, the mind control to create this perception that, you know, unless you're out there getting loads of money, then basically, you know, you're a waster and there's no point in you being around. And that's what's being driven. And this was when I was thinking about this event, I thought, you know, it's starting to become more and more obvious. And the articles are in the media telling people what's occurring. And then this one caught my attention. This was in The Guardian, and I think it was mid-November. So it was only about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And this was the graphic. This is the graphic that was with the article. But the headline was "The Bad Behavior of the Richest. What I Learned from Wealth Managers." And this is a guy who worked in the city, obviously worked with the extremely wealthy in the country. And he said, "The habits of the wealthiest mirror the supposed pathologies of the poor. But while those in poverty are called lazy, the rich are dubbed bon vivants." Says, in nearly a decade, interviewing the wealth managers for the 1%, if it taught me anything, it's that the ultra-rich and the ultra-poor have a lot more in common than stereotypes might lead you to believe. In conversation, wealth managers kept coming back to the flamboyant vices of their clients. Well, we know what that means, don't we? It was quite unexpected, in the course of discussing tax avoidance, to hear professional service providers say things like, "I've told my colleagues, if I ever become like some of our clients, shoot me. Because they are really immoral people. Too much time on their hands and all the money means they have no limits. I was actually told by one client not to bring my wife on a trip to Monaco unless I wanted to see her get hit on by 10 guys. The local sport," he said, "was picking up other men's wives." Morality doesn't even come into play, of course. The clients of this Geneva-based wealth manager also believe that they are descended from the pharaohs. Now, anyone who's been following my work for the past decade plus will know that I have made the observation many, many times that those who believe themselves to be the rightful rulers of this planetary fiefdom actually believe themselves to be directly descended from the Nephilim. And the pharaohs, of course, are descended from the Nephilim, or many historians, orthodox and otherwise, believe that to be the case. So now, whether this is true or not doesn't actually matter. It's what they believe. And because it's what they believe, it gives it a life. And I'm not going to go into all the detail of the blood issues between the Nephilim and humanity. But if you want to see a synopsis of that, then look at the presentation that I made in 2006, in July 2006, called The Hidden Agenda. And it's where I actually outline the detail behind this observation. Now, what's that, 2006? So that's 12 years ago. 12 years ago, the likelihood of a comment like that, believe that they are descended from the pharaohs and they are destined to inherit the earth, would be dismissed as absolutely rampant Barkan conspiracy theory. But he goes on in the article, if a poor person voiced such beliefs, he or she might well be institutionalized. For those who work with the wealthy, however, such eccentricities are all in a day's work. Indeed, an underappreciated irony of accelerating economic inequality has been the way it has exposed behaviors among the ultra-rich that mirror the supposed pathologies of the ultra-poor. But if you're at the wrong end of the scale, then obviously you are dismissed as a social miscreant. But if you're at the other end of the social scale, then it's normal, as Jeffrey Epstein has, of course, established.
Well, that's the voice of Ian R. Crane, as he liked to be called. I always just called him Ian Crane. But he was speaking one of the most recent talks. He's been ill for quite a long time with cancer, apparently, but he finally died on Thursday, the 25th of February, age 64. Martin, what do you make of his analysis there? I think, you know, you might be picking over a few bones with him over 1979, but he's describing there at the end there a kind of amazing double standards, isn't he, really, between the rich and the poor. So the idea really is that the law is really only there for the poor, and that the rich can really skip around and do whatever they want.
Yeah, and I think, I'm glad to see that he said, well, if they believe it, that's important, whether it's true or not. I think a great influence over the wealthy gangsters, if we can call them that, has been Ayn Rand and her novels, which came out in the 1950s originally, Atlas Shrugged and so on. And they're basically pot boilers with nothing in them. In Atlas Shrugged, the wealthy classes decide that they're going to withdraw from the US society because they think they're being unfairly treated by the masses, and they go to live in the mountains. And as a result of this, the country goes to pieces, and eventually the proles beg the wealthy to come back and run things for them. And you'd think, well, this is just a bit silly. And she claimed that she'd invented a new philosophy called objectivism, which has got no philosophical roots whatsoever. It just means that you should look after number one.
In philosophy, surely, I mean, there is a sort of, you know, some philosophies do that. I'm thinking about people like Nietzsche who are kind of saying,
all
we really need is people to just carry on and be naturally selfish, and that's just the way things are, and that's how, and that's justified. In fact, there are, you know, whole philosophy departments around the world publicly funded to preach this stuff. So there are some philosophers that do say.
I think that's a bit of Adam Smith basically argued that the pursuit of private interests led, because of the invisible hand of the market, to the public good. Ayn Rand and others weren't saying that. They were saying there is no public good. There's just selfishness.
No, that's right. And in fact,
that is a further step. And what's absolutely extraordinary is people like the former head of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, who's supposedly a bureaucrat, was a personal friend of Ayn Rand and subscribed to her philosophy of perfect selfishness.
That is
a step beyond the argument in favour of the free market.
All that's going on here.
Look after number one and the hell with everybody else.
All that's going on here is incredibly selfish, money-grubbing people are grasping around for something to legitimise their hideous selfishness. That seems to be what's going on. But anyway, I just thought it's lovely to hear Ian's voice, and a great wise man, who's one of these people who I love that has got the bigger picture. So it's very sad to say, 25th of February, Ian Crane died age 64, and his alternative view conferences have been absolutely amazing. I would certainly agree with everybody that's been on there. But there's been some fascinating insight. People like Norman Baker doing one of his first public speeches about the death of David Kelly as part of that, which the mainstream media simply refused to do. And so Ian made sure that he organised the conferences to make sure there was a space where that kind of thing could happen. But we're going to move on now to look at Alan Watt, who died on the 4th of March, aged a very young 55 years old. And he was quite well known for a program which was mainly, I think, heard in the United States, actually, although he's Scottish, called Cutting Through the Matrix. And we're going to hear a little bit longer than that clip now, about 15 minutes of Alan taking us through. I mean, he had this amazing way of explaining things which you thought you knew, but you didn't know, and making incredible. He's like a jigsaw puzzle man. Making fantastic connections in history. And it is incredible how little of our history, which is real history, making the real connections of the battle that's been going on for millennia between the oligarchy and ordinary people. Alan managed to do it. And he's, I think this is part of a longer talk, which I'll put links up with Ian's Democracy and Change talk and Alan's Understand the Control to Set Yourself Free talk up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But let's have a listen to Alan Watt now. Wonderful that he has the same surname as the inventor of the steam engine, who was also Scottish and part of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, working very closely with John Robison, who wrote this book, Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All Religions and Government, which is a fascinating insight into the takeover of Freemasonry and other groups by the Bavarian Illuminati. Or whether you believe it or not, John Robison was a friend of James Watt, but we're not talking about James Watt now. We're talking about one of his, someone with a similar name, Alan Watt, who died just a couple of weeks ago, age 55. Understanding the Control to Set Yourself Free.
I'm Alan Watt, and I'm an author and researcher into geopolitics, really, and history. I follow where the world has been, the techniques were used to bring them to those stages, and I plan them to where we are today and where how the future is planned. I've researched so many books. I've got a library of my own. I like paperback books, or at least hardback books, because they're permanent records of the past. And if you can't understand the past, you won't understand the present or the future. I've also been in the music business, heavily involved for years. And I saw how culture creation worked from the top, and how generations were swayed into new fashions, new ideas. I've been following the histories of what's now called the New World Order for many, many years. And I try to go into the books written by the big players, the technocrats themselves, those famous people like the Kissingers, the Brzezinskis and so on, the Huxleys, the Lord Bertrand Russells, who all worked for the same organizations. And I came to the conclusion, really, there was only one big organization with many subcategories. These boys tend to publish the world that they saw coming into view, and they wrote it in their own hand. Basically, they told us where they were taking the world. And when you start studying these things about the age of 14, 15, or even younger, and reading their books, and you live long enough, you will see that the world has turned out exactly as they planned. This can't be coincidence. And who can really write up a wish list and make it happen globally, unless there is an organization very, very powerful, probably the only organization really on the planet, an organization that can fund all sides, all oppositions, and using the synthesis of conflicting parties, they can literally make the world come into view as they planned. They plan in centuries, and the astonishing thing is when you go into the United Nations, which was loosely based on the Soviet system, they plan certain parts of their agenda in 50-year plans, some in 100-year plans, and some even in 150-year plans. for different aspects of it. The Russells, the Huxleys, and so on, Brzezinski's, also use the same terminology with their long-term plans. And you've got to understand, too, that nothing in culture comes out from the grassroots. Even Plato talked about that thousands of years ago. He said that if it was a grassroots movement, really coming from the people, then those in charge, the dominant minority, would lose control. Therefore, every change in culture, right down to fashion and music, and this was written 2,300 years ago, had to be authorized from the top and promoted from the top if it fitted with the continuance of control over the public. And these are sciences which were taught down through the ages, are still taught today to the big players. And they've used it to the full in the 20th century, now into the 21st century, with the use of television, mass communications, radio, etc. Everything has been given to us for the appropriate time and stage in the actual planning. And for those who are coming into this kind of study, it's best to go into the books, as I say, written by the big players themselves. They love to boast. Yeah, Kissinger's got lots of books out there, so has Brzezinski. These are probably two of the master players in geopolitics. Try to stay away from all the conspiracy books. They're also put out there on purpose. Very fascinating books. But they lead you in circles forever without giving you the overall picture. Two, the fact that every generation has a purpose up until this present time. And in a post-industrial era, these big boys have decided, and their masters too, that we are simply superfluous and they no longer need us. Hence, we have big foundations coming forward and organizations like the Optimum Population Trust who have decided to come out openly and demand that governments start radically reducing the populations. We are now the useless eaters, as Lord Bertrand Russell called us. Our ideas, our opinions on everything, our worldview, even to do with population and the fake view that we're overpopulated, is all projected to us by the mainstream media working in concert for their masters. And we begin to parrot what we hear through repetition. And that's so important, is repetition with slogans and catchphrases. And once you hear it happening in your own local group, your milieu, then you know it's working. And the camera can make anything appear to be true. You'll see that in India, for instance, they always use the same streets of Bombay to make you think that you're massively overcrowded. And that's the impression people think of the entire Indian continent. The Indian continent is huge, with thousands and thousands of miles of forest where no one lives. It's the same in Africa, too. China, being the model state for the world, for instance, put into effect the United Nations policy to the extreme with its population reduction and the movements of people off of the rural areas into cities. They said that years ago. Right now, they're in the process of moving 200 million more people off into the major cities, and that's in the major newspapers. The cities appear to be crowded because everyone's being moved into them. In the Western world, since the 1950s, again, under the term of urban sprawl and stopping urban sprawl, the Western countries also signed agreements to do no more building in the outskirts and of the major cities. All existing buildings have to be used or else knocked down, replaced with even higher ones. But regardless, with the immigration and the free flow of people now from third world countries, the Western countries appear to be overcrowded. And yet the UN's own statistics show, and sort of the national census show, that the Europeans, for instance, Canadians and Americans, who have been here for a couple of hundred years, are actually in decline. So the overpopulation problem is simply an image projected by the media as more and more people are crammed into the same cities and they bring more immigrants in to fill them. But I also realized the system of schooling when I was going to school was bogus. The histories were bogus. And I was very, very lucky to have access to very old libraries, town libraries. Some of them had reference books going back into the 1700s, written at the time. when you compared the histories I was being taught in school to the histories that were written at the time, they were completely different. You had a deeper understanding of how geopolitics had been used in the past to even populate the country of Canada. London couldn't get immigrants to go off into the new colonies. What they did for Australia was to create so many laws that you couldn't help but break them, and poverty, and therefore stealing a loaf of bread to feed you or your family would get you deported to Australia with your family. That's how they populated Australia. Crime. They created the laws for crime. With Scotland, we had a rebellion, which could have been rigged, and I often think it was, and the whole of Scotland was punished. And they deported millions of the Scots off to the Americas to populate the Americas. This is geopolitics in action. That's how it works. And whole peoples are often moved from their land because the elite masters want them elsewhere to be productive for them, themselves, the masters. When you look at the strategy for the US and Canada, again, long-term strategy, long-term planning, you'll find that the big corporations of their day, the Hudson's Bay companies, the Fraser companies, were given charters to own the land before Canada was Canada or US was the US. They were simply called the Americas. These are private international corporations that had the power of life and death over everyone who lived within their areas. The Queen or the King had a consulate in every country. Lieutenant General, or Governor General, they call them. We still have one in Canada today who represents the Queen. They have all the powers over life and death of subjects under that governor. How they stopped rebellion in the past was to give us an idea of what they called democracy. They knew from the Chartist movement in Britain, for instance, and elsewhere, other countries, people were demanding rights for the first time. And so once again, they gave us champions to speak on our behalf, which calmed the people down, thinking for the first time in history, the people were involved in their own destiny creation, and nothing was further from the truth. Because the planners knew that once you bring people into a country or a continent, create real wealth for them and get businesses going, clear the land, drain the swamps, and so on, they can take it all away from you through laws 200 years down the road. And that's what's happening now. Long-term geopolitics once more. And if you think I'm kidding about this, go into the history books written at the time. They're still there in some of the libraries. And you can also go into the art of geopolitics. There's even videos on YouTube on Brzezinski boasting about how he set up the Taliban in Afghanistan. You'll see him encourage them to fight the Soviets at that time in the 1970s. And he actually says, yours is a holy war. This man, who obviously believes in nothing but himself and his own peer group, is encouraging another people to go and fight a holy war, a jihad. And he uses these terms against the Soviets, knowing full well, once it was set up and it was backed by the CIA, that 10, 15 years down the road, they'd be a problem. And then they'd have to go to war with the very group they'd created to fight the Soviets. That's what's happening today. Long-term strategies. Well, that's how history has always been run. If you can go into the books where you find the British Home Office is mentioned, study the history of the diplomatic corps. Because the diplomats were spies. They would go into territories, set up embassies, collect intelligence data for future invasions. Their job was also to try and grab the rights of minerals, gold, silver, etc., across the planet, all natural resources, and find ways, long-term strategy, to either bribe it off the present rulers of those countries or else create an ultimate war with them and simply steal it under the guise of occupation. We're living through a stage today, as I say, where this is all coming to a culmination. This is the post-industrial era. We're post-technical, almost, in the West. It's all done in other countries, all the technical stuff. And Brzezinski himself talks about the technocratic era, where the future will be for an elite with a highly trained bureaucracy underneath them and scientific elite who will not need the human labor that they've needed in the past. Human labor that is excessive and is unemployed and is hungry is now a threat to that established elite. So now they're doing something which they can only do to the human species. They don't need to do this with animals. With animals, just go out and hunt them and kill them. We are the only species that has to be convinced to allow ourselves, for the good of all, to be sterilized and bring down the population through abortion on one end and euthanasia on the other, under the guise to save the planet. And unfortunately, with the massive propaganda campaigns that are all over media and every country at the same time, with all the big foundations backing them with unlimited financing. Remember, the foundations are owned by the international bankers themselves. Then they can pull all of this off, and unfortunately, it really is working. In kindergarten now, you walk into a kindergarten anywhere in Europe or Americas, and you'll see the rainbow inside every single one of them. You'll see all the terms about the world. Here's the globe. We're all global. And you'll see the greeting messages everywhere, everywhere, and how sacrifice will have to be made to save the world and the planet and future generations of society. Sacrifice. You tie that together with the institutions that were comprised of the Fabian Society. It was a member of the Royal Institute for International Affairs. That's one society. The Council on Foreign Relations is also the same thing as the Royal Institute for International Affairs. They are what Thatcher and Professor Carla Quigley called the parallel government. They have told us what the future is going to be. Some of their members have even written books about the need to cull off massive amounts of the population by any means possible. And so we see this final stage being pushed as they convince us that we are the problem.
So that's the voice of Alan Watt, Cutting Through the Matrix star, and a great Scottish thinker. He died on the 4th of March, age 55. Very sad to hear of his passing. I did actually try to contact him a couple of years ago, but he wasn't able to be interviewed, so I've never had a chance to interview him, but an absolutely incredible jigsaw puzzle man. Alan was... one of those rare people who was able to see, I think, a picture far, far bigger than many people, many analysts, who are looking at, you know, zooming in and looking at a specific issue, a specific conflict, a specific ideology, whereas Alan, more than almost anybody else I've ever come across, saw these things in their, much more importantly, in their historical context. And also in the direction that they're going, because, of course, if you don't see the bigger picture, you're really not seeing very much at all. As a way of sort of just paying tribute to both Ian Crane and Alan Watt, what I want to do next week is to take a really good look at these institutions like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Roundtable Groups, the Milner Group that started all this off. It was certainly one of the things I've come to understand over the years. It was as the British Empire was at its height towards the end of the 19th century that Cecil Rhodes and his friends decided that they were now in the position to take over the world. And as the British Empire got bigger and bigger, they started formulating plans in order to do that so that they could extend the empire and really control everything. Now, you know, there's a question of whether that was being done as a Christian operation or not, because of course a lot of the benefits that were brought to the world by the British Empire were actually just simply Christianity, and these moral ideas were positive. But of course that was a kind of Trojan horse, where really what they wanted was the resources from those countries. But anyway, we'll have a look at that next week. I think that would be a good tribute, at least something to Ian and Alan, it's fascinating to hear from, I think, just now. And I'll put details of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and links to the full interviews, both of those full interviews, as well as the longer interview with John Harris about Rudolf Hess. So time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, who bowed out at the last minute there. Who can blame him after 2.5 hours? And also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Since Yahoo and Google manoeuvred me onto their email lists and then banned these lists, either for posts that I couldn't moderate or for fake anti-Semitism claims, the only way to be included on my weekly email circulation list, I'm afraid, is with the old-fashioned manual way. Email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. And you'll find that address on the contact tab at www.thisweek.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays on the stream, the PRSC stream, and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. And over Sunday lunch in two places, well, I think only one now, Richie Allen stopped doing it, at camberleysradioqk.com. And I think that's also, Radio Q are now streaming this live as well on a Friday, so well worth checking them out. Do please make recordings yourself, as we have occasionally been beset with gremlins and have lost complete shows because for some reason they weren't being recorded. That was when we were on BCFM. Do feel free to download and rebroadcast this show anywhere you like, and we'll list you here. But do credit this show at www.thisweek.org.uk, and you can hear some of these longer interviews, including, I'm hoping, maybe some with Webster Tarpley and his World Crisis Radio, which is excellent every week, on this stream throughout the rest of the week. My three e-books are published in the 3 weeks of the Halloween lockdown of The Traitors of Arnhem, The Siege of Heaven and The Siege of Heaven Reader, The Traitors of Arnhem, all about the origins of the now apparently vanished, for their final push to take over the world, Bilderberg Group, back in the 1940s and 1950s. And The Siege of Heaven being a collection of articles that I've written, and The Siege of Heaven Reader, a load of extracts from the end of the medieval period right till today about secret societies and secret power behind the scenes. I send free watermark versions of these out often with my weekly email, but they're all available, the free watermark ones or the actual books themselves, the ebooks, via bilderberg.org, and the, or on the Martin Bormann tab of our show page at thisweek.org.uk. If you've got a site or a story you'd like to share, you think there's anything that I've missed, or have a correction, do please reply to the weekly email or just email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk, hopefully with a link or two, or a scan if you've got some documents, if possible. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling in the meantime, so here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And by the way, just one little last thing. I say God bless. Mustn't forget that, must I? The fasting suggestions that for this Easter, because Jesus did it for 40 days and 40 nights, didn't he? Easter is a central annual sacred time for Jews too, of course, because Jesus' crucifixion happened at the Passover festival, a celebration of what the angel of death passed over, that was marked out by lamb's blood, the houses of the Jews who were in Egyptian captivity. Some I know have done 40-day fasts, but that's pretty drastic. Water-only fasting, particularly for the overweight, is a powerful spiritual discipline which usually involves a hump of feeling grotty between 24 to 48 hours after the morning the fast begins, as your body adjusts to thriving off stored fuel rather than what you're digesting. So have an aim of just 3 or 4 days if you've not fasted before, possibly longer if you have, and even take a go as long as you can if you really want to push it. But fasting is not a hunger strike, it's a spiritual discipline. So if you feel unwell after the 48 hours, either stop the fast or take some medical advice. The upside is you're purging a lot of toxins from your system and allowing your body to do a kind of service on itself without all the energy the digestive system takes to run it. Give it a break. Also, one can feel more spiritually in touch with God, meditative, contemplative, and taking a rare step back from life. So as we enter the week running up to Easter, do give a water-only fast a thought in these profoundly dark, secular, pseudo-scientific times. It's a challenge of self-discipline, turning one's body into one's temple, if you can. If you or your family don't feel up to a long fast, just Good Friday AM to Easter Monday supper time might fit. On the third day, he rose again. Remember that? Focuses us on the evil, smashing self-sacrifice of Christ's death and resurrection. And if you don't feel up to that, you can still go for a Thomas Aquinas fast, taking only one meal a day. So thanks for listening. Do feel back and reply and share advice or corrections. Thank you for being you. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Double, ooh, ooh, ooh. How am I gonna get home? Black coffee, I'm so dizzy. Black coffee, please get busy. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Help me so I can get home. Had a little too much hoopy soup. All I meant to take was one. Now my head is going loopy loop. Some stuffy kid, what fun, oh. Black coffee, help a fella. Black coffee, what'll I tell her? Ooh, 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 I'm afraid to go home. Thank you.
Thank you.